check this out, man.
People gonna rise up and take what's there. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution.
This Week in Radical History for the week starting August 25th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer, and more radical info can be found in the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
Yes, I'm a nerd, and for all you Star Trek fans out there, ever wonder in the Voyager series where the term Marquis came from? You know, the underground group fighting against the Federation? Well, the Marquis were the French resistance group fighting the Nazi occupation during World War II. Many of the Marquis were Spanish anarchists who took control of Paris after the Nazis fled on August 25th in 1944. Also, on August 25th, 1950, President Harry Truman orders U.S. Army to seize all the nation's railroads to prevent the nationwide strike to happen. The railroads are not returned to their owners until 2 years later. However, of course, their profits were always returned to their owners. Also on that date in 1968, the Battle of Lincoln Park Democratic Convention in Chicago, with demonstrations and police riots. 10,000-plus demonstrators versus 11,000 Chicago police, 6,000 National Guard, and 7,500 U.S. Army troops, as well as 1,000 FBI, CIA, and Army Navy Intelligence Service agents participated. The world would see what democracy looks like as the government beats and tear gases the protesters. Lastly, for August 25, 1985, the White House confirms that Ronald Reagan was an FBI informant with his own Secret Service number in Hollywood in the late 1940s while heading up the Screen Actors Guild. How many names do you think this Fink named while he's being paid to protect the actors he's in charge of? This Week in Radical History for August 26th, 1786, Shays Rebellion, armed insurrection begins in western Massachusetts. Armed local farmers upset about the draconian debt laws that often put farmers in debtors' prison and the government taking their lands, host an uprising against the government. For months, they successfully stopped local courts from holding debtors' trials until the government raised its own army and put down the rebellion by force. More rebellion occurred on 1913 in Dublin, as the 1913 lockout in Dublin happens, when tram drivers left their cars in the middle of the road during a bourgeoisie horse show week. Workers around Dublin had horrid living conditions due to poor wages. 26,000 families lived in 5,000 tenement buildings, which gave rise to the highest infant mortality rate in Europe, among numerous other problems. The Dublin factories locked out the workers, who at the end were on the brink of starvation, destroying the union and hopes for higher wages and better living standards. Also on August 26, 1919, more labor unrest. United Mine Workers, UWM, organizer Fanny Sellins is gunned down by company-bought sheriffs during the Pennsylvania coal strikes. She had been a witness to the beating and death of a fellow union organizer. The newspaper report stated, "The mine official snatched the club and fell the woman to the ground. This was not on company ground, but just outside the fence. She rose and tried to drag herself. The official shouted, 'Kill that, blank.' Three shots were fired, each taking effect. She fell to the ground, and the official cried, 'Give her another!' One of the deputies, standing over the motionless and silent body, held his gun down and without averting his face, fired into the body that did not move. One of the deputies picked up the woman's hat, placed it on his head, danced and stepped, and said to the crowd, 'I'm Mrs. Sellins now.'" Lastly, for August 26, 1968, the National Student Association reports 221 major college protests against the Vietnam War held nationwide since January of that year. This Week in Radical History for August 27th, only got a couple items. 1927, thousands turn out in violent protest over the deaths of Sacco and Vanzetti in Paris after two U.S. courts find the two anarchists guilty of firebombing in a trial that would give kangaroos a bad name. Dozens of other protests erupt around the world. Also on August 27th, 1988, George Bush Sr. says that atheists should not be considered for U.S. citizenship. Lastly, in 1992, Catholic Church apologized to Indians for the Spanish conquest. Well, better late than never, I guess. A couple years ago, the Catholic Church also apologized for its involvement in support of the Nazis and the Holocaust. And, of course, a couple years ago, the Catholic Church also apologized for the molestation by their priests. How Christian of them. Perhaps George Sr. should have insisted that Catholics can't be considered for citizenship. This Week in Radical History for August 28, 1926, in Nicaragua, for the umpteenth time, Marines land at Blue Fields to protect American interests. On this date in 1927, Ashes to Ashes, as Sitko and Vizzetti funeral is held from the north end to Forest Hills Cemetery. The anarchists are cremated. In September, all Hollywood newsreels of Sitko and Vizzetti are ordered destroyed by William Hayes, Hollywood movie czar. Here is a brief report about Sitko and Vizzetti's memorial held last week in Boston.
Emperor Norton's stationary marching band provided a contrary festive atmosphere to somber issues of immigrant rights, death penalty, state repression, and the memories of Sitko and Vizzetti.
The 81st anniversary of the murder of two comrades, Sitko and Vizzetti, and to keep their memories alive. And if their memories are alive, they are.
Why do you think it's important to keep their memories alive?
Because what happened 81 years ago is happening today, all in our streets. Right today in Boston at the Caribbean Festival, where the cops are importing Irish police to conduct surveillance on the crowd goers because of the ICE raids, and which are elected officials cooperate.
No more disparity! No more immigration raids!
It was a motley crew of 50 to 60 dedicated anarchists that marched from Copley Square to the streets of downtown Boston to the North End. Red, anarchist, and black flags were waving in the breeze. A large banner of Sitko and Vizzetti led the march. This was the day, August 23rd, 2008, that marked the 81st anniversary of their execution.
I was just talking to a bunch of Italian tourists who were wondering, you know, why do we care about Sitko and Vizzetti? Why are we doing this for the Italians?
That was the question I was about to ask you. Why focusing on Sitko and Vizzetti?
Well, Sitko and Vizzetti are a really, really important part of anarchist history to begin with, but especially the history of revolutionaries in Boston. The Italian anarchist movement in this country was really strong at that time, and we're trying to bring back the anarchist movement to be what it once was and then more. We want a revolution, so great.
Molly Alderstein of BAM. She also works with the Lucy Parsons Center and later addressed the rally at the North End.
An extremely important thing to remember today on the anniversary of their execution is that the case of Sitko and Vizzetti is not some past aberration of our criminal justice system. We can't just look back and remember and breathe a sigh of relief, because this is how our criminal justice system operates. If anything, it gets worse with time, if only because it has become so pervasive that it seems normal now. From 1956 to 1971, COINTELPRO used similar surveillance, disruption, and entrapment tactics on a number of movements, from civil rights groups and the Black Panther Party to socialist and anti-war groups. Currently, to name just a few examples, immigrants, minority communities, and environmental activists are being heavily targeted in the same way. Like in the time of Sitko and Vizzetti, the state uses war in order to scare the general population into submitting to whatever security measures that it deems necessary to protect itself. Then it was World War I, and now it's a stream of never-ending wars. The war on drugs, the war on crime, the war on terror. If we ever get out of Iraq, there's sure to be another country ripe for the occupation. Iran sure is looking like a good prospect for both of our leading presidential candidates. The media certainly doesn't help in making us so afraid of each other that we've submitted to living in a police state. We need to open our eyes and start taking control of our own lives, our own communities, our own media, and our own security. We need to realize that the news on the TV and in the papers is not our own, but a perverted, biased, and censored version of reality designed to keep us scared and in the dark, grasping tightly onto the state. A venomous barbed wire slicing into our hands and poisoning our minds. We can create our own media. There are already projects out there that you can plug into, or you can start your own. If we want to truly honor these fallen comrades, we must continue their work and the work of so many others who are now dead or imprisoned who dared to fight against the exploitation of the state. If we continue the struggle, Sitko and Vizzetti live!
Bells from the old North End church chimed as the anarchists held their rally across the street. This program was recorded, mixed, and edited by your announcer, Chuck Rosina, for the Boston Community Reporters Project. Thanks to Freeman C. for providing technical support, and thank you for listening.
Also on August 28, 1931, the Italian government requires university teachers to take a pledge of allegiance to fascism. Why bother? Of the 1,200, only a dozen teachers refuse, and they are fired. the moral and critical bankruptcy of the intellectuals at universities and their pathetic submission to the state power and will is, as always, demonstrated once again. Also on August 28, 1955, while visiting family in Mooney, Mississippi, African-American teenager Emmett Till is brutally murdered after speaking, quote, inappropriately, unquote, to a white woman. The questionable trial that follows, and Mrs. Till's decision to display her son's mutilated remains during an open casket funeral, helped to mobilize opposition to segregation in America. Lastly, on this date in 1968, Chicago FBI agents report Ginsburg chanted unintelligently poems in Grant Park. Unintelligible poem was William Blake's The Gray Monk. This Week in Radical History for August 29, 1911. Ishii, the last Stone Age man in America, surrenders in Northern California. Of the 2,000 members of his tribe alive in 1864, only 15 were alive in 1865. The rest were killed by the whites. For a good book on Ishii, read Ishii in Two Worlds. Also on August 29, 1968, Chicago police continued to brutally attack demonstrators, reporters, and bystanders at the Democratic National Convention. The whole world is watching. The official investigation later termed this a police riot. As of that date, 27,508 Americans had died in Vietnam since January 1st of 1961. In another land based on freedom on this date in 2000, the Australian government says it will restrict visits by UN human rights inspectors because of its criticism of the treatment of their Aborigines. Lastly, on this date 3 years ago, Hurricane Katrina hits the south, destroying much of New Orleans, where upwards of 50,000 mostly poor African Americans were unable to escape. At the end of this piece, I'll have a short montage of interviews I got while I was down in New Orleans right after Hurricane Katrina hit. This day in radical history for August 30th, this was caught on film in 1979. President Jimmy Carter, attacked by a rabbit on a canoe trip on April 20th in Plains, Georgia, finally makes the headlines. Those rascally rabbits. If you ever get a chance, try to view this footage as a Secret Service man tries to beat down this rabbit with an oar as it tries to jump in the boat with Jimmy Carter.
What's no ordinary rabbit? That's the most foul, cruel, and bad-tempered rodent you ever set eyes on. Run away! Run away! Run away!
This Week in Radical History for August 31st, 1836, U.S. Marines again invade Peru to protect American interests.
The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case.
On this date in 1925, Haiti, U.S. Marines end 11-year occupation. The freedom-loving democracy dictatorship they leave in place continues to pillage and murder Haitians for another 60 years, ending what was once called the wealthiest country in the Western Hemisphere.
And so we give support to repressive governments in South Korea and Brazil and Chile because it is in our national interest to do so. We will supply sophisticated weapons to backward countries and betray an entire people like the Kurds, all because it is in our national interest. What may be difficult to accept is that there's nothing new about that. In fact, it's what we hire our Secretary of State and our Foreign Service to do for us. The myth is that since the First World War, we were ever able to conduct our foreign policy any other way. The United States is a superpower with enormous and divergent interests that it is committed to protect. And at best it is naive, at worst hypocritical, that they don't understand what's involved in that harsh reality. I'm Ted Koppel in New York.
Only two more items for 1958. Fidel Castro and Che Rivaro and the ragtag rebel army begins a walk into the woods, and they will return and start the destruction of the U.S.-supported mafia-controlled dictatorship in Cuba. Lastly, in 1970, Philadelphia police raid offices of local Black Panther Party. Among those arrested were young teen Wesley Cook, later known as Mahmoud Al-Jamal. Mahmoud was a targeted victim of the FBI's infamous and corrupt COINTELPRO program and is now in death row after a highly prejudicial trial. One of his appeal judges, for example, is one of his original prosecutors. And justice for all. This has been This Week in Radical History, recorded at the Glee Glee Studios. Since this week is the third anniversary of Katrina, I'll be ending the show with a short montage of interviews from New Orleans I got while volunteering right after the storm hit. Lastly, I'd like to welcome another station airing this little weekly ditty. Welcome to Radio Free Kansas, an awesome radical internet radio show. Check them out sometime. That's Radio Free Kansas. Before ending, a little nod to Michael's 11-year-old son.
You have learned much, young one.
War's not misled great, isn't it?
Don't give up on Howard Zinn. Until next week's This Week in Radical History, as always and forever, I'm yours in a struggle, Mike Cannon.
As some of you may know, I went down to New Orleans recently and interviewed some residents and activists of that devastated area. To close my show today, I'll have this five-minute montage of those interviews.
We're not just down here for a couple of months. We're working here to make this into a permanent clinic here in the community that's run by community members and controlled by community members. It's a long process, and folks want to help out. This is a place to do it.
Of all the problems of racism and classism that were existing down here before, what happened down here was a whole series of human rights violations against people of the Gulf Coast. Was perpetrated by the city, state, and federal governments in conjunction with many national and international-based relief organizations.
That lack of organization from the government and what they're kind of where they're falling through, what you've seen where they fall through at?
Well, from what I've seen, it seems to be very bureaucratic in terms of getting supplies to any of the relief centers. You have to be able to prove ID of residency, you need to prove that you're from the area, and most people lost most of the paperwork since Katrina and Rita had hit, that they don't have the proper paperwork to provide to show that they're resident, and without that, and you go to a federally run relief center, your chances of getting supplies are next to nothing.
It's a class war that's being waged down here, and that folks around the country have to remember that just because, you know, CNN or Fox News is saying, oh, all services are 100% open down here, that's a crock of shit. I mean, you walk around in a, you know, 10 square block area and you'll see that, you know, half to two-thirds of the businesses still aren't open. And it's a matter of blatant lies being perpetrated against the people of New Orleans saying, oh, they're all hunky-dory now where there are whole neighborhoods that don't have power, that don't have water.
A friend of mine that works for Palestine Indy Media that has been in Palestine for long periods of time, repeated visits, said that she felt like this was Palestine. Between the military checkpoints and the curfews that would change on a whim of the authorities, the curfews, you'd get a different answer whoever you asked, because there were no military, there were no police here in some places for the first 3, 6 to 8 days, depending on what specific neighborhood and who you ask. There was none of that presence on the ground. And then as soon as the military was here, they were acting like the checkpoints were necessary to keep out looters. I was like, you missed the boat, you're too late, you're lying, you're hypocritical, you're just wrong.
It's really important that people get down here if they can. I mean, I know everyone's busy. I know everyone has a lot of things they need to do with their time. But this is a place where people are needed. I know the Red Cross and FEMA are saying they don't need more bodies. And the reason that they're saying that is because they don't want people coming down here. They don't want people to know what they're doing. They don't want people to see the atrocities that are being committed every day. They don't want people to see the damage. They don't want people to really realize the war that's being waged right now, the war for New Orleans that's being fought.
لم تطيق فوز فزع طفلة تنتطي فوز فزع.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. Israel's desperation to counter the success of the growing boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement is becoming more and more apparent. The Israeli lobby's attempt to organize a state-by-state campaign to pass legislation that would punish support of BDS gathers momentum across the country, though so far has been unsuccessful in Massachusetts. Now, Governor Baker has been asked to sign an anti-BDS letter from the nation's governors. There is an active request to call Governor Baker to urge him to not sign the letter, citing the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which protects the right to boycott. There is such a long and rich history of the use of boycotts to further human rights in the United States, beginning with a struggle to gain independence from England during the American Revolution. There are original documents from that period on display at the Concord Museum, including personal pledges by colonists to boycott British imports, making them vulnerable to the charge of treason against the British Crown. However, joining the boycott was seen as an act of patriotism by the colonists. Later, after the success of the American Revolution, the right to boycott was enshrined in the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights. Boycotts have been essential to the growth of the labor movement and essential to the civil rights movement. Remember Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott. And also remember the role that many Americans played in the support of the boycott of South African products, which led to the ending of the apartheid regime. Now the Israeli lobby, supported by those who should know better, including many state and federal legislators, governors, possibly including our own, is waging an unconstitutional and, one could argue, un-American campaign, often in the name of anti-Semitism, to punish boycotters of Israeli goods. They are on the wrong side of the law and the wrong side of history. Israel knows that it's increasingly being seen as a pariah state throughout the world and is desperately fighting back. In the following article in Mondo Weiss, Alison Dagher documents the witch hunt that is beginning within Israeli society to root out support of the BDS movement. Israel will soon search for, deport, and prevent the entry of international activists involved in the boycott, divestment, and sanctions BDS movement, based on intelligence provided in part by hotline tips to a task force, said Public Security Minister Gilad Erdan. If you have information about someone pretending to be a tourist who is actually staying in Israel as a boycott activist, Erdan said, tell us about it and we will remove him from the country. Recommendations for who to deport will be under the purview of a joint team which will operate to expel and prevent the entry of boycott activists to Israel, Erdan said. The group will comb through intelligence files and solicit tips on foreign visitors to Israel and the occupied Palestinian territory who are working here to incite and inflame, to collect information on Israel and then distort it and use it abroad to promote boycotts against Israel. While the program is likely to be far-reaching in data collection on the whereabouts of internationals involved with pro-Palestinian human rights groups, only a fraction will be issued notices to leave, according to an unnamed source close to the ministers. For instance, we have to think whether deporting certain individuals will benefit or harm Israeli interests. If it's a foreign national whose pro-boycott activities are minor, and he is mainly involved in promoting human rights, then we have no problem with that. But if it's a group which is mainly involved in promoting the boycott and delegitimization of Israel, then we have no interest in him coming in here, the Israeli newspaper source said. While Iran did not specify which groups will be the targets of the anti-Semitism BDS efforts, Aretz intimated the International Solidarity Movement, ISM, could face the first round of banishments. What really scares me is to not have witnesses, Neda Golan, the ISM's co-founder, told Mondo Weiss. Her group's members operate in the West Bank and Gaza, where volunteers primarily document the Israeli military and settlers in confrontations with Palestinians. ISM volunteers also accompany children to school and farmers to harvest their olives in areas where they face ongoing settler and military violence, said Golan. We find that our presence sometimes results in reducing the level of lethal force used by the Israeli military against unarmed Palestinians. Golan says ISM has been targeted before. Last fall, Israeli settlers in Hebron posted placards in the city with the names and photographs of ISM volunteers, asking for others to report them to the Israeli authorities, she said. The Palestinian BDS National Committee released a statement today indicating that this group also anticipates removals. Deporting BDS activists in order to silence them and undermine their principal support for Palestinian human rights is not only anti-democratic, it is yet another incident of Israel shooting itself in the foot. If anything, we expect such acts of heightened repression to boost support for boycotting Israel back in those activists' home countries, said a spokesman for the group. Israel has taken steps in recent years to outlaw campaigns to boycott the Jewish state over its occupation of the Palestinian territory, and in the past denied entry to those suspected of pursuing pro-Palestinian activism during their vacation and educational stays. In 2011, Israel's Knesset passed a law under which Israeli companies could sue boycott activists for losses incurred as a result of boycott campaigns. The law is limited to Israeli citizens and does not allow for criminal charges. No business has yet to use the law to seek damages from boycott activists. Still, Golan noted, Israel has for more than a decade already deported activists involved in pro-Palestinian groups and many individuals uninvolved in the BDS movement. Such instances are common knowledge, she said, though until Sunday, Israel had never explicitly stated whether a policy existed to deny entry for those entering for activism purposes. It is enough to have a book by Edward Said or an Arabic-sounding name, Golan said, in order for an individual to be deported at Israel's airport and border crossings. Many are activists and many are not and have just been caught in the Israeli paranoia, she said. That was excerpts from an article by Allison Dagher, writing in Mondo Weiss. Our feature presentation this morning is an interview with journalist and author Max Blumenthal by radio journalist Abby Martin. It is Blumenthal's take on the uniqueness of the current rebellion by the youth of Palestine against the Israeli occupation.
Today I'm sitting down with Max Blumenthal, investigative journalist and commentator on Israel and the struggle in Palestine. He's the author of the award-winning book Goliath and the recently published expose, The 51-Day War, where his on-the-ground reporting in Gaza in the aftermath of Operation Protective Edge documented the harrowing reality of Israel's war crimes. I wanted to find out what he discovered during his coverage of the war and how it relates to the current uprising in Palestine. Max, can you break down what's happening right now and what people are calling the Third Intifada?
It doesn't fit within the parameters of what we know an intifada to be, which is a nationwide uprising directed by political factions. What we're seeing is a completely disorganized rebellion by a generation of youth who've grown up after the Oslo Accords, which laid the basis for a two-state solution and the U.S.-led peace process was established. And they've grown up in that reality. It's a reality of separation, exclusion. They've witnessed the destruction of the Palestinian grassroots. All of the institutions of Palestinian life, especially in East Jerusalem, have been virtually eliminated. In the West Bank, they've been folded into the PA and the NGO infrastructure. And they've seen very little opportunity or hope. The occupation has deepened and tightened. They watched a 51-day assault on the Gaza Strip and felt helpless. They've seen the Palestinian de facto leadership in Ramallah, the Palestinian Authority led by Mahmoud Abbas, coordinate security with their occupier and sick their Palestinian forces on them, carrying out raids, for example, at Bir Zeit University. And so this generation has decided to act on its own. This has been building for a long time. But now that this generation has come of age, they're lashing out at their occupier. They're going out and demonstrating at the friction points of occupation. So, for example, at the checkpoint at Beit El in Al Bire outside Ramallah, there are regular demonstrations. They're throwing rocks and Molotov cocktails at heavily armed soldiers. Around Nablus, which is a site of settler terror, and especially in Hebron, where settlers, the most radical settlers in all of Israel-Palestine, are embedded in the old city and regularly terrorize and prey on Palestinians. They are carrying out attacks. There are knife attacks inside the Green Line, which is a symbolic act. And what they're doing is they're sending a message that as long as we're occupied, there's going to be a price. You're not going to be safe, and you won't be normal. As Netanyahu said recently, we are destined to live by the sword. But in Tel Aviv and Haifa and all of the cities inside Israel's interior where most of the Jewish population lives, it will be like we're in Europe. Or as Ehud Barak, the former Israeli prime minister and defense minister, said, we'll be a villa in the jungle. And when young Palestinians enter the villa with knives or with rocks or whatever they have, they're reminding Israelis, you're not a villa in the jungle. You're the jungle in our villa. You're in the Middle East and you can't just put up a wall and pretend we're not here.
Why is the Al-Aqsa Mosque center to this political struggle?
First of all, Jerusalem has been separated from the West Bank and Ramallah under the thanks to the Oslo Accords. And the Oslo Accords provided the basis for a separation regime. The separation regime was manifested in the separation wall, which separates occupied East Jerusalem from the West Bank. The Israelis proceeded to destroy all of the key Palestinian institutions in East Jerusalem, like Orient House, which was supposed to be the future seat of a Palestinian government that would govern from the capital of East Jerusalem. That all moved to the other side of the wall, to Ramallah. And then every other institution proceeded to collapse. The only thing left was the Al-Aqsa Mosque as the symbol of Palestinian nationalism in Jerusalem. To me, it's much more about the Palestinian national struggle than about religion. But in Israeli society, you've seen in Jewish Israeli society a development where religious nationalist class has risen in power. They're really reorienting society into a theocratic dominionist direction. And for them, the Al-Aqsa Mosque is a symbol because it's the Temple Mount. There were supposedly Jewish temples there 1,300 years ago, and they aim to rebuild the temple as a symbol of the replacement of Israel as a state governed by civil law with a more theocratic, openly Jewish state, what I would call JSIL, or the Jewish state in Israel and the Levant. The Knesset and all of, and many of the ministers in Netanyahu's government are religious nationalists. The pressure on Al-Aqsa increases, and the pressure on Jerusalem increases, and the conflict, such as it is, takes on a religious dimension and begins to resemble a clash of civilizations instead of a struggle over rights and land. The Al-Aqsa Mosque has been almost completely encircled by Israeli settlers, and they've accomplished that through brute force, throwing Palestinians out of their home and replacing them with religious ultra-nationalists. They've built tunnels under Al-Aqsa Mosque, which actually have destabilized the infrastructural integrity of the old city of Jerusalem. And now they're beginning to prevent Palestinians from praying at Al-Aqsa for the first time so that Jewish religious extremists can ascend and conduct their own kind of prayers. And so all of these disruptions have destabilized Jerusalem. And you have 300,000 Palestinians in Jerusalem living under occupation with constant pressure from settlers. They're living among the most extreme elements of Israeli society who are armed. They themselves are not armed. The youth have been, you know, traumatized by this environment, and they're lashing out. And the friction point is the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And remember, Al-Aqsa Mosque was where the Second Intifada began, when Ariel Sharon ascended with his surrounded by security forces, and it led to a complete bloodbath.
It has been another relentless day for the medics here as casualties continue to pour in. Tragically, many of those are children.
Neema is just 2.5 years old. She was caught in a missile attack from an F-16. She has a broken nose and a fractured skull. She hasn't spoken a word.
We were sleeping. Our house completely collapsed on us.
Doctors at the hospital here were unable to save Shahid.
Well, the siege on Gaza no doubt plays a role in the anger throughout all of Palestine. Max, you were on the ground, and you outlined some harrowing details in your book about what you found. Outline the devastation that took place during last year's 51-day war.
I immediately, as soon as I entered Gaza, went to Shajaiya, which was the, you couldn't really call it a neighborhood. It's more like an entire city east of Gaza City that had been wiped off the map by Israeli artillery and pretty much every mode of destruction available to the Israelis. Every house I went to there, they weren't really houses, they were ruins of homes, and speaking to elderly women and entire families about having their family members summarily executed in front of them, interviewing paramedics who found a woman, an 80-year-old woman, in a chicken coop who had hid there for 8 days living off of chicken feed, pulling dead families, entire families out of homes, and finding that they couldn't pull them out because their limbs would fall off, and having to bring in bulldozers to bulldoze bodies into mass graves, interviewing the Rajela family about fleeing tank fire and leaving their severely disabled daughter on the road in her wheelchair, and then finding her in her wheelchair a week later riddled with bullets. These kind of stories were what I heard day after day. I mean, everywhere I went, I was walking through a real-life horror film, and this was the Palestinian experience in Gaza for 51 days. It was like a sequel to the movie Saw. How do you deal with that psychologically? That's the question we have to ask now, because the humanitarian situation is worse than it's ever been in history. The United Nations Relief Works Agency predicted that Gaza would be uninhabitable by 2020, and it's currently uninhabitable. People are trapped there. Most can't leave. And who are the Jewish Israelis, the 300,000 who participated in this operation. How do they think? Netanyahu was reelected in a surprise to a lot of Americans after Operation Protective Edge. You have to go into a very right-wing eliminationist mindset in order to justify what you did, and it's Netanyahu is able to cater to that. Just the amount of violence I witnessed was only the beginning of a nightmare that's continuing through the present. The Gaza Strip has 80% of the residents of the Gaza Strip, 72 to 80% are refugees. So it's a warehouse for surplus humans. And for the first time, you actually are seeing, for example, a wave of child suicides. I interviewed the father of Salem Shamali, who was killed on camera.
Guys, this one.
In the hand.
He was looking for his wounded cousin, and he was killed.
Allah. Yalla, yalla, yalla. Shadu la ilaha illallah. Allah.
Was reported on by international news, and the family, it really affected the family to find out, you know, our son was killed, and we found out because someone emailed us the video of his killing, and we only knew it was him because we recognized the sound of his screams. So Salem's father told me that his other sons are and children are making amanat, which is a unique term that doesn't really have a clear English translation, but it means like their last dying wishes. So the violence, of course, is on, you know, it's a physical violence, but there's a psychological component to it. The Israelis threatened to bomb the main hospital, the Al-Najjar hospital in Rafah, and so everyone had to pour out of the hospital, wounded people, people missing limbs, and the entire medical staff, and the only place left was the Kuwaiti hospital, which is actually a 20-bed OBGYN and geriatric clinic in the center of town that's completely unequipped for this kind of disaster. And the doctor I met there, Samir Holmes, told me that he was treating amputees on the floor, that his own medical staff was coming in dead, and that the carnage got so bad that he had to order ice cream coolers from local shops to store the corpses of infants. And this image that is widely available of four infants in white death shrouds in an ice cream cooler, I think is iconic. It's the image that distills the entire sensibility of Israeli society at this point and how little value they place on Palestinian life.
And as Israeli forces were using the Hannibal directive and kind of indiscriminately shooting even on their captured soldiers, Al-Qassam Brigade was changing its tactics over the last couple of years. We saw it act pretty differently during the 51-day war. Talk about what happened there.
The tactics of Al-Qassam as a guerrilla force in face-to-face confrontations with Israeli soldiers was untested, and the Israeli military underestimated their capacity. Through the tunnel network in the south of Gaza, the Al-Qassam brigades and Hamas had been able to import some heavy weaponry, like the kind of weapons that Hezbollah in southern Lebanon had. I mean, Cornet anti-tank missiles, rocket-propelled grenade launchers, lots of AK-47s, and you know, some heavier machine guns that could be carried. But more importantly, the Al-Qassam brigades imported the tactics of Hezbollah. They may have received some Syrian training or indirect Syrian training through Hezbollah. And this proved very effective when the Israeli military invaded in July the neighborhood of Shujaiya. You saw basically local teams of fighters situate themselves in tunnels in and around Shujaiya and then wait to ambush Israeli soldiers who had initially entered in very lightly armored vehicles, which were supplied by the U.S. military as surplus and were left over from the Vietnam era. And some Qassam sapper teams were able to destroy these vehicles by simply planting charges on them by hand, explosive charges by hand, displaying a lot of bravado. But the most important tactic, I think, that was put on display in Shujaiya was the willingness to engage Israeli troops at less than 15 meters away for prolonged periods of time. During Casled in 2008-2009, Al-Qassam would stage hit-and-run attacks, and they learned from Hezbollah that You don't hit and run. You stay in the fight, because that neutralizes the two strengths that Israel has over every other military in the Middle East: air power and artillery power. If you have soldiers engaged in face-to-face fighting, you can't provide air support or artillery support, because you'll kill them. So the Israeli military founded, this is the Golani Brigade, its most elite special forces, who have very little experience, actually, in real fighting, really motivated, well-armed forces. I mean, they're more used to beating up on farmers and stone-throwing kids in the West Bank. They found themselves losing their lives at an alarming rate. Injuries were coming in by the dozens. And I think it was the night of July 14th. I might be getting the date wrong. They decided to retreat and carry out one of the most cowardly military maneuvers in modern military history. Retreat in armored personnel carriers as fast as they could to the border of Israel and Gaza, and then unload with what amounted to half of the artillery pieces in the Israeli military and blanket the entire area with 120 and 155 millimeter howitzers. And that's what resulted in the destruction of Shuja'iyya, was actually the defeat, or the moral defeat, of the Israeli military. The most famous operation was at Nahal Oz. This was later on in July. A team of Al-Qassam fighters with GoPro cameras attached to their helmets attacked an Israeli military base. The goal was to capture soldiers, I think, which would have been a game changer, would have given them a lot of leverage in negotiations, might have even ended the war. But they managed to kill almost every soldier they encountered. They lost only one member of their team and made it back into the tunnel with one of the soldiers' rifles, which was upheld as a trophy at the end of the war. This operation demonstrated, or had two effects. One was it demonstrated that the Al-Qassam brigades aren't interested in attacking civilians, because Nahal Oz is also, the base is part of a kibbutz. I mean, they could have gone and killed civilians, but they chose to engage soldiers. And Al-Qassam General Commander Mohammed Deif stated clearly that we're attacking soldiers while you bring the roofs down on the heads of our civilians. And the second effect it had was securing almost unanimous support in Palestinian society, including among, Fatawi, Fatah supporting people in Ramallah, for the concept of armed resistance. You're used to seeing your relatives and your friends and even experiencing yourself humiliation at the hands of Israeli soldiers, especially if you live in Jerusalem or one of the areas where settlers are. And for the first time, you see young Palestinian guys dressed up like commandos, giving the Israeli military a bloody nose and taking the fight to the enemy. I mean, that had a strong psychological impact in Palestinian society. And so now there's a lot of criticism of Hamas, dissent against Hamas in the Gaza Strip. But I don't know anyone who would question the importance of maintaining a kind of guerrilla force that's highly militarized and is there to fight the Israeli military.
The Israeli parliament has approved a law that imposes stiff penalties on people convicted of throwing rocks at moving vehicles. Under the law, stone throwers could face 10 years in prison and up to 20 years if it is determined that they intended to seriously harm the occupants in a vehicle. The lawmaker who sponsored the legislation said that one-third of arrests in Jerusalem are connected to stone throwing.
So the government's going to great lengths to crush resistance there. The latest measure is the 20-year prison sentence for anyone throwing a stone. Max, talk about the significance of stones in Palestine and why you think this law was passed.
In this case, this law was passed by the Israeli parliament, a very extreme law, and members of the Labor Party and the opposition supported it. It wasn't just right-wingers who were determined to throw young people in jail for almost their entire adult life for throwing a stone. It shows how threatened Israeli society is by the smallest, most minuscule iterations of Palestinian resistance, even symbolic resistance like stones. And now it's become a symbol of resistance and telling Israelis that they're not welcome. You know, why are you throwing rocks at a soldier who's wearing a Kevlar vest and is protected against, you know, 7.62 millimeter live rounds? The Israelis are responding now with unprecedented measures. I went to the hospital in Ramallah in July and interviewed a doctor who told me that he was treating dozens of gunshot wounds to the legs, and that Israel had a shoot-to-cripple policy. And he provided me with documentation, which pretty much showed that soldiers were cracking down on demonstrations with live fire to the legs. Not only that, but some of the bullets were what Palestinians call ton-ton bullets or dum-dum bullets, which are expanding rounds. So they'll bounce around inside your limbs and expand and really cripple you for life. The Israeli... this bill to jail stone throwers for 20 years is complements another measure put into place by the Israeli military and police, which allows even members of the Israeli police to shoot demonstrators with 22 caliber rounds from Ruger rifles. The 22 caliber rounds are less likely to kill. They're more likely to cripple. They shatter bones. They often bounce around inside your body. This is standard practice now. Standard practice to shoot demonstrators with live weapons.
The Palestinian, unfortunately, instead of building a Gaza Strip as the Singapore of the Middle East, they choose the terror path.
They want to pile up as many civilian dead as they can, because somebody said they use, I mean, it's gruesome, they use telegenically dead Palestinians for their cause. They want the more dead, the better.
In the letter, and I'll read it to you, you say the formerly populated areas will be shelled in Gaza with maximum firepower. The entire civilian and military infrastructure of Hamas will be destroyed entirely. And then you say those who insist on staying will be required to publicly sign a declaration of loyalty to Israel.
People might be surprised to learn that Netanyahu is actually not the most right-wing Israeli government. That it's actually just gotten more and more right-wing over the last decade.
Benjamin Netanyahu, I've been saying for the last 2 years, exists at the hollow center of Israeli politics. You know, I talked about the generation of Palestinian youth, the post-Oslo generation, and how they've developed. But within Israeli society, there's been a parallel development with the post-Oslo generation that's extremely radical, sees no hope for, you know, a two-state solution or a peace process. Their approach to the Palestinians is that there's no partner for peace and that they only understand force. This is a generation that's adopted a very strongly Jewish identity and a belligerent Jewish identity, as opposed to the identity of Israel's founding generation, which was based around a concept of Israeli nationalism, which was racist, but which allowed for some place for Palestinians or Arabs. The kind of sensibility and identity this generation has adopted leaves no place for anyone who's a non-Jew. And this generation is embodied by the current justice minister, Ayelet Shaked. That bill we talked about to punish stone throwers for 20 years, that was her baby. She ushered it through the Knesset. She's young. I think she's, you know, she's our age. She's very telegenic. She's very popular in Israeli society. She's not a settler. She comes from a core Israeli city. In many ways, she's kind of a carpetbagger. And she is genocidal in her approach to Palestinians. In fact, she called for genocide during Operation Protective Edge, for exterminating Palestinian mothers to prevent them from giving birth to little snakes. She's in charge of the Justice Ministry. And you look at the direction of Israeli society. You just look at the polls from Israeli Democracy Institute that show that a majority of youth state their refusal to sit in a classroom with an Arab or a non-Jew, that a majority of youth favor a kind of one-state apartheid solution. In 2011, in this poll, a plurality of Israelis stated their support for placing Arab citizens of the State of Israel in internment camps during wartime. Three-quarters of Israelis in a recent poll reported by the Times of Israel, three-quarters of religious nationalist Israelis declared their support for the full ethnic cleansing of Palestinian citizens of Israel, the 20% of Israel who are Palestinian citizens. And 80% said that they boycott Arab businesses. So you look at the direction of Israeli society and you have to conclude that there's no hope for change from within, that those of us on the outside who want to see a different outcome than perpetual conflict can't work from inside Israeli society. We don't have a place for convincing people. There has to be pressure from the outside. And the pressure has to start here because it's Washington and the U.S. government that has funded radicalization in Israel. They've paid for this whole project because every time Israel builds settlements, every time they give money to the settlers, every time the education ministry brings kids to Hebron to see the settlements, every time that they decide to teach kindergartners about the Holocaust and scare kindergartners into an authoritarian mindset, and every time they assault Gaza and get as much time as they want, the U.S. is there to pay for the whole project and to rearm them. And so they're rewarding radicalism in Jewish Israeli society, and that's really ultimately why this trend is continuing.
That was Max Blumenthal, interviewed by radio journalist Abby Martin. We cannot leave this week without a Palestinian Olympic story. And of course, the major story concerns the impact of the occupation on the Palestinian Olympic athletes, in particular the story of swimmer Mary Al-Atrash. The following is from Mondo Weiss. Mary Al-Atrash swam for the first time in the Rio Olympics in the 50-meter freestyle. She finished third in her heat and finished in 28.76 seconds, beating her personal best of 29.91 seconds. That finish did not affect the broader ranking. Sadly, Mary finished 63rd of 91 athletes and did not take part in the semifinals, which featured only the 16 best swimmers. Last month, Mondo Weiss interviewed Mary Al-Atrash, the 22-year-old swimmer from Beit Sahor in the West Bank, who was part of the largest delegation Palestine has ever sent to the Olympic Games. She told us about her difficulties to train in a swimming pool that does not match the Olympic standards and explained that although she technically lives close to Jerusalem, where such swimming pools exist, she could not go there to train. After our story was published, a controversy started. Israeli authorities explained that Mary never applied for a permit to train in Jerusalem. Other media outlets declared that Olympic-sized swimming pools existed in the West Bank. We investigated this complex situation. After COGAT, the Israeli Minister of Defense Organization, coordinating civil affairs between Palestinians and Israelis in the Palestinian territories, published a statement saying Mary Al-Atrash never applied for a permit to train in Jerusalem, we contacted Mary and the organizations that supervise her training, such as the Palestinian Swimming Federation and the Palestine Olympic Committee. Indeed, it seems that Mary never applied for a permit, and neither did a lot of other Palestinian athletes. They explain this situation by emphasizing their movement restrictions. They say they could be stopped at any point while going from one place to another and therefore don't feel safe moving from one city to another. They also mention that roads or checkpoints are sometimes closed, which implies a chance of wasting time that they could use to train. The Palestinian Swimming Federation stressed the difficulties that all the athletes face to enter Jerusalem for training, and that permits are limited time, and that athletes still have to go through checkpoints, even if they have a permit to train in Jerusalem, which makes their situation unstable and puts them at risk for wasting their training time. To understand the difficult situation and the restrictions of movement for Mary Al-Atrash, here are options to reach Jerusalem, where she could find an Olympic-sized pool to train from Bet Zohar, where she lives. She could go through Bet Jala, a village between Jerusalem and Bethlehem. There are two checkpoints to cross, one at Har Gilo and one through tunnels on Route 60. She could also go to Bethlehem and then from this city drive to Jerusalem, and she would still have one checkpoint to go through, nearby the separation wall. The Rachel's Tomb checkpoint, also known as Checkpoint 300, reportedly sees thousands of people crossing daily. It is considered to be one of the busiest checkpoints between the West Point and Israel. Lastly, she could travel straight through Bet Zohar to Jerusalem, where she would have to cross one checkpoint off the Road 60 on Road 398. It should not be more than a 15-minute long drive, but then it depends on how long you spend at the checkpoint. It can be several hours, where you also have to change public transportation since no Palestinian-plated car can enter Jerusalem. Besides, there was a controversy regarding the absence of an Olympic-sized pool in the West Bank. The Jerusalem Post conducted an investigation and finally concluded that there are no 50-meter-long swimming pools meeting the Olympic standards in the West Bank, although there is an ongoing project to build one. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on our computer at WZBC.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
Back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. How democratic is the United States when the Democratic Party officials at the heart of the party keep getting assassinated? Weeks ago, we heard from German political scientist Klaus Kopf, the director of the Hamburg Peace Studies Institute, Dieter Lutz, had screamed at him, "You naive blue-eyed bleep, do you think the US president is really voted in? Where do you live?" Now, the evidence is rolling in that Lutz was right. No less than five suspicious deaths of people closely connected to the Democratic National Committee, who were all in positions to blow the whistle on the conspiracy to make Hillary Clinton the Democrat Party's presidential candidate, no matter what the cost. Also, Crimea. Russian and Ukrainian troops massing on either side of the border there after a saboteur cell of Ukrainian soldiers was arrested by the Russians inside Crimea. And The above-the-law banksters should never be far from the headlines, as today's medieval overlords. They're deciding on which companies live and which companies die. Nearly 100 senior bankers have died, most in suspicious circumstances, over the last 3 years. Why is nobody joining the dots? Plus, the crowd-funded documentary The Killings of Tony Blair is out. We have a sneak preview and asked, has our own film and TV industry lost the will to investigate domestic corruption? Looks like they have. Our sister show Dialects back at noon every Tuesday. This week, the author of Swallow This, The Dark Secrets of the Food Industry, the wonderful Joanna Blythman. Fascinating interview, that. And more from the Chicago mob hitman who killed President Kennedy, James Files. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. But we start this week, Martin, by going to Yemen to have a look at the MSF, who've evacuated staff from 6 North Yemen hospitals after airstrikes. Doctors Without Borders said the organisation has lost confidence in the Saudi-led coalition's ability to prevent such fatal attacks. Doctors Without Borders said on Thursday it will be evacuating its staff from 6 hospitals in northern Yemen. Now, Martin, this is getting pretty horrific, isn't it? After the breakdown of peace talks, it looks like the British aircraft, the British bombs the Saudis are using are just being used to destroy hospitals, kill ill people, and also they've been targeting schools as well.
Well, you'd have thought if some country invades another country, which is what's happened here, Saudi Arabia has invaded Yemen, you'd have thought that the international community would say, hang on, we don't allow invasions. When Saddam invaded Kuwait, everybody went nuts.
But we do. We do allow invasions. Well, it's basically the survival of the fittest these days.
It's one law for us and another law for them, isn't it? The Saudis also, of course, invaded Bahrain during the Arab Spring in 2011. They went straight across the border there and crushed the Arab Spring. That's two countries that Saudi Arabia has invaded. Who are the aggressors in the world? Remind me now.
Well, Yemen.
It's supposed to be the Russians, isn't it? Oh, no, hang on a minute. It's the Saudis working with the British intelligence services, armed and trained by our special forces.
Yemen is the poorest country in the Middle East. It's also one of, if not the most ancient culture in almost in the world.
Well, the whole point about Yemen is it's where the population of the Arabian Peninsula lives. And the creation of North...
You mean not in Saudi Arabia?
No, Saudi Arabia is a great big pile of nothing. The vast majority of the population, and of course, historically, Yemen was the civilizational heart of Arabia. It's the, you know, it's where all the people live. So the Saudi Arabia was created by the British in the 1920s to make sure that the oil in the Arabian Peninsula was in the hands of a tiny elite of supposed aristocrats that the British had managed to find, and made sure that the Yemen and was excluded from that. So the money from the oil wouldn't be spent on the
poor
people.
So if you want to meet an Arab, Yemen's the place to go to, not Saudi Arabia.
Absolutely, there's far more people in Yemen, and incidentally, of course, the Saudi army is made up of many people from Yemen, because many people from Yemen end up in Saudi Arabia. The Bin Laden family originally Yemeni, and they went to Saudi Arabia because that's where the money was. This is a conflict which is every bit as bad as what's going on in Syria, but it's one of those ones we're not supposed to worry about. You see, there are some wars where we're supposed to get really aerated about what's going on. That terrible Assad and all the terrible things he does in Syria. And I'm not trying to belittle what's going on in Syria. It's pretty horrific. But there are other wars, for example, this one, which we're just not supposed to think about.
But
don't worry about it.
Martin, the Saudis are saying, well, the thing is, time is on our side in Yemen.
Well, it's on their side in one sense, that they can carry on bombing and killing. They've got more equipment than their enemies. Although the Yemeni army have split, and they have actually got some quite useful equipment. So they managed to land a long-range missile on Dhahran Air Base, which is the heartland, the nerve centre of control. And they managed to kill some NATO personnel who were there helping to advise.
And it's
the
also
Saudis.
British are over there. British soldiers
British
are over
military
there
involved,
helping apparently with the targeting, which doesn't seem to be working very well when they're in schools and hospitals.
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, Médecins Sans Frontières are not always entirely reliable when they say that they're being hit. Sometimes they are and sometimes they aren't. Let's just put a little question mark over that. But I think it's pretty clear that when you invade somebody else's country, which is what Saudi Arabia has done, then the casualties that happen as a result of that, civilian and otherwise, are your responsibility. You shouldn't invade other people's countries. You're not allowed to under international law, but the Saudis have just done it with absolute impunity, not only without us not stopping them, but with our military personnel helping them. Now, I'm not a pacifist. And when somebody invades your country, you've got the right to defend yourself. So if any British military personnel are out there and are unfortunate enough to be wounded or killed, then I'm sorry, but I'm not going to cry about that.
Well, I mean, the thing is that with air superiority and with satellite intelligence from the US and Britain helping them, I mean, the Saudis are bound to win, aren't they?
No, because in actual fact, they've got a mercenary army. The Houthis have been fighting. The Yemen, there's a culture of military training inside Yemen, because people have always
almost
been
every
armed.
Family is armed.
A bit like
they?
Afghanistan. Yeah, absolutely.
It's amazing to think of a country where guns are in every family. I mean, we heard that little clip from Bill Cooper at the very start there about the United States and having a lot of guns there. But actually, what they developed in Yemen before all this, and possibly now too, is actually quite a good gun culture where people weren't just kind of drunk and shooting people in the street, etc., and that there was a real responsibility about holding guns.
Well, Yemen's a complicated place. It's not straightforward, and the internal struggles in Yemen are not straightforward in any way.
Is there any hope of peace?
Only if we put pressure on Saudi Arabia, and Britain is quite important.
But hang on,
here.
We're making a load of money here.
Oh, we are. And also, of course, this fulfills the anti-Iranian goals of the Yinon plan developed by the Israelis, of which we are a part. In other words, what goes on in the Middle East, the media coverage of it is propaganda. With certain things we're supposed to care about, other things we're not supposed to care about. So on the front page of The Guardian today, it's the horrific story of a poor boy who was nearly killed by an airstrike in the minority of Aleppo, which is controlled by mostly foreign terrorists who've come in with the help of Western special forces and the Saudis into Syria. Meanwhile, things go on in Yemen and we hardly hear about it. The fact of the matter is that the Saudis were behind the uprisings in Libya, they're behind the uprisings in Syria, they're behind the invasion of Yemen, they've crushed the democracy movement in Bahrain. The Saudis are an aggressive military power, and we arm, train, direct, and help them. Their chaps are all trained at Sandhurst. Now, sometimes, as I've said before, if you're not a pacifist, you have to defend yourself. What should people do about a state like Saudi Arabia, which is attacking everybody like that?
Yeah, I suppose if another country suddenly kind of started bombing us and attacking us, we would like to think we could fight back. But anyway, also just moving over to Syria, northeast from there, is Russia is now using Iranian air bases in the fight against al-Nusra. But hang on a minute, al-Nusra has changed its name to the Sham Liberation Front.
Well, they've changed their name because they were put under pressure by their Western backers. It was a bit embarrassing that they were Al-Qaeda, so now they're not Al-Qaeda. It's the same guys, but they're not Al-Qaeda.
Well, they
now,
changed
so that's
from, they originally changed from Al-Qaeda to al-Nusra, and then they changed from al-Nusra to Sham Liberation Front.
Well, the fact of the matter is that all of these rebel groups inside Syria are armed to the teeth with Western kit,
now,
including anti-aircraft and anti-tank missiles.
We're supplying them, as we heard last week, with recruits, the Canadian intelligence bringing these British school kids down through Turkey into there. We're also providing the Sham Liberation Front with weapons. Do any of these get to ISIS?
Yes, because, of course, what happens is you train the so-called moderate rebels, and what's a moderate rebel? I would say the PKK are moderate rebels, and they've just killed 6 or 7 Turkish soldiers yesterday. They're moderate.
Well, they also get called in our media the opposition, don't they?
Ah, yes, the opposition. Now, the fact is that when we do things like that, encourage armed uprisings, suicide bombings, they've been given anti-aircraft missiles, can you imagine, TOW missiles by the Americans. And these all leak into the hands of the more extreme elements. And, of course, the more extreme elements are the ones who want to fight on to the end. In actual fact, what should be happening in Syria is that all the rebel groups should be putting down their arms, negotiating with the government, and in actual fact, the Syrian government has offered amnesty. to people, if you put down your arms, we will either let you go or you can just go away, and we won't even try and punish you. But they're fighting on because the British and the Americans, Hillary Clinton's very keen on this. Assad must go, even though he won a democratic election 2 years ago overwhelmingly. And his the Sunnis, who are the majority in Syria, the Syrian Arab army is dominated by the Sunnis. So it's not a sectarian force. And the people who are mostly fighting against them are not even Syrians. I remember some years ago in Aleppo, there was fighting going on there, and a Western journalist interviewed one of the rebels, and he said, well, you're having some trouble here. And he said, yes, we are having some trouble because we've got no local support here. So that was them. That was their own assessment. There was a NATO internal report which was leaked, which said that the government had about 70% support amongst the population. And there was about 5% of the population supported the armed uprising, and the others were not on either side. That was NATO's own internal assessment of the balance of power on the ground in Syria. And that's why you're not going to win. That's why Saudi Arabia isn't going to win in Yemen. It's why the US Army was defeated in Iraq. It's why the British Army was defeated in Helmand Province. You can't win in the modern world in those
circumstances. In Syria, we had a bit of an exclusive last week when we put two and two together live on this programme, didn't we, about the fate of Khadija Sultana. We were hearing a lot about her last week on the national news, again and again over Thursday and Friday last week, and actually on the BBC's Any Questions and on Any Answers on Saturday, about this young girl, 15, 16-year-olds, three of them went over to Syria. It turns out, though, that they were smuggled from Istanbul on a bus. Basically, they were helped onto the bus and all the way down to around about 40 miles from the Syrian border at the south of Turkey by a former Syrian army colonel who'd been recruited by the Canadian Intelligence Service, the CSIS, Canadian Security Intelligence Service. His name was Mohammed Al-Rashed.
Yes, so in other words, we've got evidence that these girls were actually recruited and groomed online and then taken to the front line by this chap who's actually working
but
for Western intelligence.
I mean, these
services.
Are statements by the Turkish police. Can we believe them?
Yes, the Turkish police have demonstrated some independence. I think that is the hope as we go forward into this maelstrom, is that genuine police work, which genuinely tries to find the terrorists, is to be commended. The Turkish police also arrested a supposed aid convoy that was absolutely stacked full of weaponry for ISIS. They arrested it and interdicted it on the border, and then the guys who were driving the aid convoy turned out to be MIT, that is to say Turkish military intelligence. Now, what's happened there is that Erdogan put the police on trial for treason, and then journalists who reported that the police had busted the MIT supplying ISIS, they were put on trial for treason. But, of course, that's not just Erdogan doing that, because the MIT works very, very closely with MI6, with CIA. And as I said in the first hour, we've had at the Old Bailey in this country somebody who was recruited by to go and fight in Syria, and it was for an MI6.
It does often seem, yeah, doesn't it, that the intelligence services are a complete law unto themselves, actually a bunch of criminals, really.
Indeed.
But the police do have a kind of role in trying to moderate what they do. Now, one of the things that,
in the best circumstances, yes, but the police can also be suborned, of course.
One of the things Rashed, Mohammed Al-Rashed, this former colonel in the Syrian army who'd recruited by the Canadian intelligence, said in his statement, and his statement is there up there online, I'll put a link to it on our show page, he said he promised to email details of all those he smuggled, which totaled around about 150 Britons over 2 years, 150 Britons, South Africans, Indonesians, Australians of various nationalities into Syria over 2 years, to his contact who's called Matt in the Canadian intelligence service, who he describes as a 35-year-old, 5 feet, 11 inches tall, about 200 pounds. He said they would give me citizenship if I would gather information about the Islamic State, share it with them, and help these recruits down to ISIS.
Now, what the Canadian intelligence services will no doubt say, if anybody bothers to ask them, and of course they won't, because the British media had an overwhelming duty to report that these girls were recruited by the CSIS. They didn't report it, did they? We're reporting it on this show, but they didn't report it. But presumably their defence would be, well, we need to infiltrate these organisations. That's why we're taking 16-year-old girls from Britain and pushing them into the front line, because we're infiltrating ISIS. Now, I would argue that that just doesn't stand you know, if you were taking 25-year-old guys from Afghanistan, you might just be able to say, well, actually, we're trying to infiltrate ISIS, but not 16-year-old girls from Britain. This is just... And then we get the whole ISIS is evil propaganda stuff, but the fact that we've actually allowed this to happen and actually facilitated it, the Canadian taxpayer has paid for these girls to go to Syria.
Once they were down near the border at a town called Gaziantep, they were passed over, the girls, to Rashid's contact called Abu Kaka, 40 miles from the Syrian border. According to Rashid, British national Abu Kaka's real name was Ilhami Bali, and he took girls the final 40 miles or so into Syria to join ISIS. Turkish police found a vast amount of evidence on Rashid's laptop, including baggage tags, passport information and images, including several photos of these poor three London schoolgirls.
Now, the question you have to ask yourself, is this British national who took custody of them 40 miles from the border, is he working for MI6?
Who's he working for? Yeah, exactly. Austrian teenager, Samra Kesnovich, 17 years old, she went to join ISIS, and she was used by them as a recruitment poster girl, pictured with assault rifles, surrounded by soldiers. But she became revolted by their killings. She was reported beaten to death, caught trying to flee the group in 2015. And apparently, Khadija Sultana was exactly the same. She was thinking about fleeing, according to messages sent to some of her friends, and she was absolutely scared to death to leave. Once she was in there, she couldn't. Apparently, you have to swear allegiance to Baghdadi, who I think he's actually in Syria, isn't he? On threat of death, that the only thing you could do if you don't fight for him is to die.
Yes, and Baghdadi, of course, was famously photographed with John McCain on his illegal visit into Syria. Now, the fact of the matter is, I don't think that the intelligence services have got a leg to stand on here. Even if you were trying to infiltrate ISIS, and that's what you were doing, you wouldn't try and infiltrate them with teenage girls. So it's just wrong. And it also tends to suggest that the whole ISIS phenomenon has been created by Western intelligence services working with the Saudi intelligence services.
Well, there's a very strong...
Those nice guys that are bombing Yemen.
A strong implication here that they were used for sex once they got there.
Well, quite likely, but the point is that the creation of ISIS as this kind of bogey organisation, which, you know, uses its sex slaves from Britain, etc., etc. It's all great tabloid stuff. But you will know that we are probably one of the very few media outlets in this country who's pointing out the absolutely incontrovertible fact that these girls who are in Syria, who may or may not have been killed, they might be alive somewhere, who knows, we're being told lies every day, were being recruited via a Western intelligence agency. And that's on the record. People need to wake up and understand what we're up against here.
There's quite a lot going on under the veil of national security here, isn't there? We've got one link in the chain. But what about who it was that groomed the three girls to go to Istanbul in the first place and that obviously then passed? It seems a little bit like those kind of escape lines that were in the French resistance for British airmen in the Second World War. They're passed from one person to another person to another. We've got two of those links in the chain here, but we don't have all of them, do we? But that doesn't mean to say that not all of these people may be working for different Western intelligence.
Well, indeed. And, of course, General Flynn, who was in charge of the NSA, leaked the NSA report, which said that which basically said, you know, ISIS is going to get control of.
It's Michael Flynn, and he was in charge of the Defence Intelligence Agency, not the NSA.
Yeah, Defence Intelligence Agency. But I mean, he leaked the report, the internal report, which showed that they were quite blasé about the existence of ISIS and were quite keen for ISIS to come on the scene.
He called it a willful decision to allow ISIS to develop, didn't he?
That's right. Well, he, of course, he's now advising Donald Trump on policy.
Some people even talking about him being a vice presidential candidate.
Well, I don't think that's going to happen because he's chosen somebody else now. But, I mean, the point is that the evidence that the Western intelligence services have been behind virtually all the jihadi activity in Libya and in Syria is overwhelming. The Russians, I'm sure, know all about it, as do the Iranians. But British public opinion blithely, we live in a bubble where we go on about the Chowdhury being a terrible extremist, blah, blah, blah. And the fact that the intelligence services have been recruiting all of these people and funneling them into Syria is simply brushed under
the carpet. How is it that the entire London media, the thousands, probably tens of thousands of journalists working in London, London, many of them on this story, didn't put two and two together that this report was out all over the internet. Certainly had been come out in many of the international press, not in the British press. In fact, I think there was a Guardian article about it back in May last year when these girls were first realised that they'd gone over to Syria. A lot of this detail is there. All you have to do is search for it on the internet. Surely that's not beyond thousands of London journalists.
But you'll realise if you start reporting things like this, that's the end of your career.
Hang on, because I'm thinking here, maybe they're just thinking to themselves, we mustn't report anything to do with the intelligence services. It's blowing the cover of a spy.
Well, yes, and also it's self-censorship and it's also direct censorship. What happened in Turkey when the police busted the MIT convoy full of military equipment was that the journalists who'd reported it were put on trial for treason. Now, some people are prepared to be put on trial for treason to tell the truth. That's not the case here.
It's much more self-censorship, isn't it? The family of Khadija Sultana and Shamima Begum, who was 15 years old when she went over there, and Amira Abbasi, I'm sure their families have read these articles about the intelligence services being used to take their kids down to fight for ISIS.
Well, they probably have, but they're not being interviewed, are they? Basically, we're living in a manipulated reality, and it's manipulated by psychological warfare professionals who are basically trying to manipulate everybody's mind. It's, as Petraeus said, it's all about perceptions. He's supposedly the great genius of counterinsurgency in Afghanistan, the guy who said openly, why don't we support al-Qaeda in Syria? That's the obvious thing to do, as if we weren't doing it already.
Well, it seems to have forgotten about 9/11, don't they? Anyway, Bob Crow Brigade is 30 miles from the ISIS stronghold of Raqqa in Syria. British and Irish left-wing volunteers in northern Syria have compared their fight to that of the international brigades in 1930 Spain. This is in the Middle East Eye, a very good website there. The Bob Crow Brigade, a BCB, the group of British and Irish volunteers are fighting in northern Syria, named after a famous British trade union leader, are edging closer to the Islamic stronghold of Raqqa. The spokesperson described the BCB as the British and Irish section of the International Freedom Battalion, a group of left-wing foreign volunteers working as part of the pro-Kurdish People's Protection Units in the area of northern Syria known as Rojava.
Well, I mean, it's amazing that these people are there, isn't it? But, I mean, of course, the whole situation is extremely out of control. Everybody's got their finger in the pie. One of the problems with the Kurdish groups in the north of Syria is that they're not actually the majority in the areas which they control. I mean, they're very non-sectarian in their approach, so that's not necessarily a problem, but they're not actually the majority of the population. And they're also working with the Americans. They've got American special forces embedded with them. Meanwhile, of course, the PKK, who are a sister organisation, have carried out bombings in Turkey or in what they would call Kurdistan yesterday, killing a number of Turkish military personnel. And, of course, the Turkish army in the Kurdish areas of Turkey has killed hundreds of civilians since the uprising began.
The YPG they're fighting with is not listed in the West as a terrorist organisation.
PKK is.
And unlike a sister organisation, the PKK, governments have released stern warnings against those attempting to join up. According to the Kurdish news site NRT, the UK Home Office has said those travelling to participate in conflicts abroad may be committing offences.
Well, there is an issue surrounding this. We might feel quite positive about these guys going there to help defeat ISIS and support Kurdish rights, but there is an issue whether anybody should be sticking their finger into other people's business, basically, because where's the end of it?
A conflict which gets forgotten too much is the horrifying state of Afghanistan now, still with bomb attacks there happening regularly, not quite as often as in Iraq. We had a report this week that the United States has got 30,000 defence contractors in Afghanistan. So it talks about its US having officially 9,000 troops. But what about these 30,000 defence contractors stationed around the country? Two-thirds of these contractors are said to be foreign nationals, with the Pentagon saying they're mostly involved in logistics and maintenance for the ongoing war. They're brought the number of troops down, Martin, but then they're bringing in these defence contractors instead.
Well, they did that in Iraq as well, because, of course, if a contractor gets killed, that's not a military casualty. That's just... It's
a lot of people, though, isn't it? I mean, if you're talking about 9,000 troops, 29,000 contractors, that's 40,000 men. That's what the Romans used to invade Britain, isn't it, in 43 AD, 40,000 legionnaires. Now, admittedly, the population is probably different, but it's a lot of people.
Yeah, but Afghanistan is a huge country, as the Soviet army discovered. The fact of the matter is that they've not won in either Afghanistan or Iraq or in Yemen or in Syria. And all of these wars have been started by the Western military-industrial complex. They haven't won any of them. Whereas, of course, the Russians won decisively in Georgia in 2008, and the Novorossians made pretty short work of the Ukrainian far-right battalions that were deployed against them 2 years ago.
How about the bigger picture? I mean, to preserve the American way, has there got to be constant war by the US empire?
That's become the default position. But, of course... as we said earlier, if you're not a pacifist, people have got the right to defend themselves, and then there's going to be consequences.
But
if you want to go around the world kicking over people's sandcastles, be prepared for the consequences.
But people are not... there's a very few actual terrorist attacks in America. It's not as if these terrorists are going over to the US and giving them a hard time, is it?
Well, there have been terrorist attacks, as you know, but most of them are actually orchestrated by the FBI. Virtually everybody who's been convicted of a terrorist offence in the US has been set up by the FBI. They're basically people with drug, alcohol, criminal convictions, who are, and some Muslim connection, however distorted, and then they are basically set up to carry out terrorist attacks, some of which are thwarted, and they say, oh, look, we thwarted this terrorist attack. But of course, what happened in Canada, speaking of Canada, not long ago in British Columbia, is the Royal Canadian Mounted Police had set these people up as terrorists. They brought them to trial, and the Canadian jury refused to convict. They said, you've set these people up. So they had to release them. Then some week or so later, the Americans had tipped off the Canadians that there was some other jihadi chap, and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police didn't go and put him on trial, just went round there and shot him in the head. So that's how you deal with the jury problem.
Well,
don't bother with trials.
I mean, for example, Sandy Hook is one many people will remember. Professor James Tracy at Florida University, he called the 2012 Sandy Hook shooting a government conspiracy largely fabricated to promote gun control. Has he completely lost the plot?
No. We know that NATO intelligence services engage in terrorist activity in order to create psychological warfare goals, and they've been doing it for decades. We covered this on this show umpteen times. If anybody's interested, you just put Gladio, GLADO, into your search engine and have a look. It's all there. It's investigations by the Italian police force over 30 years, the Belgian police force and the Swiss parliament, the Belgian parliament and the Italian parliament have all passed resolutions recognising that this was the case. People in this country live in a bubble. They mostly get infotainment, and then the tiny bit of real news that they get is completely biased and completely leaves them none the wiser when they've consumed it. The fact is, as any dogs in the street in Turkey know this, is that NATO is a terrorist organisation. It's been a terrorist organisation for decades. They've been behind all the terrorism in Turkey. I mean, top generals in Turkey were sent to prison not long ago, last 10 years, for carrying out lots of attacks and claiming that it was carried out by Islamists, claiming it was carried out by Devrimichi Sol, which is a left-wing terrorist group, or by the Grey Wolves, which, of course, are a very shadowy right-wing terrorist group that operate in Turkey. People in Turkey know what NATO is about. People in Britain think it's about protecting us from evil.
What I will do is I'll put in a couple of articles on our show page about Sandy Hook, particularly because it's quite worrying when an academic professor starts to criticise that, rather than people taking a look at his work, criticising it, maybe peer reviewing it. All they do is sack the guy, and I think the title of his book or his article is "The Nexus of Tyranny: Tucson, Aurora, and Sandy Hook." He points out various things to do with the anomalies, the police in police statements, etc. So I'll do that, and hopefully, Yeah, that will be up on our show page by about sort of 9, 10 o'clock this evening. That's thisweek.org.uk.
Celebrating diversity, this is Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
Martin, let's go on now to talk about the Democratic National Convention. Clinton's body count, 5 found dead, all linked to the Democratic National Convention. This is Anon News.
Democratic National Committee, I think.
Committee, sorry, committee. I keep saying that for some reason. The Clinton body count grows with 5 people found dead, all with solid links to Hillary Clinton's campaign. One of them is not directly linked to the convention itself, but he is a long-time critic of Hillary Clinton, who's written loads of books. Six different books on Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton and their various scandals. And that's Victor Thorne. He was a prolific author and seasoned investigator of the Clinton family, best known as a Clinton expert. So the sort of guy that you might see pop up on the news. But no, I'm afraid he's died mysteriously. But let's go and have a look at the Democratic National Committee. Deaths. First of all, staffer Seth Conrad, Seth Rich, was the operations director for voter expansion at the DNC. Rich had all the top secret information about the DNC's inner workings, and when he shockingly turned up murdered, it had Washington insiders talking cover-up. It looked like a robbery gone bad until further details emerged. There'd been a struggle. His hands were bruised, his knees were bruised, his face is bruised, yet he had 2 shots to his back, and they never took anything, his mother, Mary Rich, told NBC News.
And then the Daily Mail go on, the mystery surrounding his death has sparked a flurry of theories posted online. Now, the other factor about this particular death is that Julian Assange of WikiLeaks has offered, I think, $20,000 for information leading to the arrest of people who carried out the murder of Seth Conrad Rich.
This guy was the main operator at the DNC with access to all of the top secret documents.
Yeah, well, the suspicion is that he was the guy who leaked the internal emails which show that the Democratic National Committee was stitching the nomination up in favour of Clinton as opposed to Bernie Sanders, and that he is the source of the WikiLeaks emails which are now being leaked about this, which the Clinton campaign are claiming have been stolen from their server by the Russians because they want Trump to win. And this is all a diversion anyway, because what the emails show, without a shadow of a doubt, is that Clinton should not be the Democratic nominee for president. She didn't, in fact, win. She cheated all the way. Lots of people had their votes taken from them. Other people were prevented from voting. And the Democratic National Committee is supposed to be neutral. It's a bit like the NEC and the Labour Party. It's supposed to be neutral about who wins or doesn't win the leadership election, but in fact it wasn't.
Well, they're bound to have their views, aren't they?
Well, they are, but I mean, there's got to be a Chinese wall between the two. But the fact is that that these people have died in mysterious circumstances, and given the kind of paranoid scenarios that are going on in US politics at the minute, Trump's people are picking up on this. It's not something that's going to be left at that, and quite right too, because we suspect people on you and I and people of goodwill all over the world suspect that these kind of assassinations are routine in the US.
Now, Joe Montana, who was a former DNC chairman, would have knowledge of the criminal activities used to get Hillary Clinton elected. Montana died from what was said to be a heart attack on July the 25th, the day the Democratic National Convention started. Mm-hmm. 47 years old and in good health, a heart attack is suspicious. Montana was on low dosage of high blood pressure medication, which means his hypertension was under control.
Well, we just don't... I mean, obviously, there is a potential pattern here that we need to pick up, but let's just make this clear to our listeners. There was a civil court case in Mississippi about 10 or 15 years ago now, where the Martin Luther King family proved to the satisfaction of a jury that the state had actually assassinated Martin Luther King, that it wasn't a lone gunman, it wasn't even James Earl Ray at all, that the gunmen were actually different, were actually from somewhere else and were connected to the state. Now, in actual fact, it's as American as apple pie. Political assassination is as American as apple pie, and it goes on all the time.
His family, that is Joe Montano's family, the former DNC chairman, they say that he was in he was packed and ready to go to the DNC convention when they found him dead. They report he was in tip-top health. His death was in hours of the WikiLeaks dump that outed the DNC chair, Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Montano was also an aide to Vice President nominee Tim Kaine, which makes one wonder what he knew.
Well, it does, doesn't it? And I'm hope you see that if you think about this, if Bernie Sanders had been the Democratic presidential nominee, then the situation in the world and in the United States would be very, very different from the way it is. But now he's not.
Well,
this is how the oligarchy controls outcomes.
Hillary Clinton was told that she would be able to run after Obama had finished his two terms at the 2008 Bilderberg meeting. She was brought and told, well, you're going to have to wait this time, Hillary, and step aside.
Yes, indeed. And she is going to be the nominee now, even though she's cheated her way to the nomination. And it may be that she's done more than cheat.
Is she going to kind of throw the fight so Trump is almost guaranteed to get elected?
No, I think what the oligarchy have now got in the United States is pretty much what they want. Hillary Clinton is an extremely right-wing Democrat. In fact, she was even a Republican at college, as she's now admitted. She's in the pocket of Wall Street. She's in the pocket of the CIA. She was very much involved in the destabilization in Libya, in the support for... I mean, Trump's accusing both her and Obama of supporting ISIS. And in fact, the evidence shows that they did. But, of course, what Trump's failing to recognise is that's the policy of NATO. It's not Clinton's policy, it's not Obama's policy, it's NATO policy.
So is Lady Macbeth going to be elected president later this year?
Well, she may well be, because she's got all the establishment behind her, including sort of right-wing Republicans who don't like Trump are basically supporting her. But don't forget, Trump himself is now being put in a position where he has to go along with what the oligarchy wants. He said a few things they don't like some, you know, sensible stuff. For like, let's not pick fights with the Russians. But if he's going to have any chance at all, he's got to drop all of that, and then they get whatever they want. They get what they want either way. It's not a democratic setup.
In another Clinton-linked death, Sean Lucas, the lead attorney who was working to expose the DNC fraud case in Florida, was unexpectedly found dead in his home. A viral video shows Lucas serving the DNC court papers. Lucas's death is still under investigation, but the mere fact that he was alive, serving court papers on the Clintons and the DNC, and the next minute dead under suspicious circumstances, leaving everybody pointing straight at the Clinton crime family. Well, this is incredible. Also, he must have realised that it was a dangerous thing to do when he served those papers to have himself videoed, Martin.
Well, indeed, but how do you fight this kind of corruption without people being prepared to take risks? People could also look up Mena Air Base, MENA, in Arkansas in the 1980s when Bill was the governor of Arkansas. That air base was used by the CIA to bring all the cocaine in from Latin America, and then it was also used to strip weapons out to the Contras in Honduras. And this was all on Clinton's watch, and he got some of the money from it, but it was actually, you know, the Ollie North Iran-Contra affair. The Clintons were involved in that, and Vince Foster was one of the close people to the Clinton. He was also assassinated at that period.
So what happens when one of the most important political parties in the world, you know, one of the two main parties in the United States, people who are trying to actually do the decent thing, do a democratic job, just get blown away?
Well, you have to ask, don't you? And, of course, it's not as if the Republicans haven't done all their nasty things as well. The Iran-Contra affair implicated both political parties. I mean, Daniel Hopsicker is a brilliant journalist, and he's basically saying that whoever wins the US presidential election becomes in control of the world's international criminal drug supply. That's what this is about. I mean, the CIA started drug dealing in the 1940s, and now the question has to be, is the CIA an intelligence agency that engages in drug dealing, or a drug dealing agency that's got an intelligence arm?
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Moving quickly to the Ukraine and Crimea in particular, Ukrainian terrorist leader has admitted to acts of sabotage. Martin, this is a bit naughty of the Kiev government, isn't it? Sending little groups of soldiers in undercover to blow things up in Crimea. What mission have you been ordered on to go to the Crimea to perform? In his statement, Panov, who's one of the leader of this group, said our task was targets for sabotage, reconnoiter. As such, we have selected the ferry from Kirsch, a gasoline camp in Feodosia, objects in Jankoy and a helicopter base and a titanium chemical plant in Crimea. The idea is just to start blowing things up. This is not very friendly.
Well,
and
they did it before with a Crimean Tartar group. They blew up the electricity supply last winter. So they've got a track record of doing stuff like this. And of course, the head of the Luhansk Republic was a car bomb that nearly killed him about 10 days ago. The problem for the Ukrainian right-wing regime in Kiev is that the rest of Europe is getting fed up with them. They want to do business with Russia. It makes sense for them to do so. They're in the way. They're being a pain in the neck. And the only way they and their US backers can kind of stop peace breaking out is by carrying out provocations like this. Now, of course, the Russians have caught them all.
When this gang was arrested,
very embarrassing, isn't
when
it?
When this gang was arrested by the FSB, the search operation was carried out during the night of the 6th and 7th of August 2016 in the vicinity of the city of Armyansk in the Republic of Crimea. It uncovered the group of saboteurs. While attempting to detain the terrorists, the FSB operative was killed by their gunfire from the saboteurs. The following was discovered on the scene: 20 improvised explosive devices with a total explosive power of about 40 kilograms of TNT, munitions, special detonators, standard-issued anti-personnel and magnetic landmines, grenades, and special-issue weapons used by the Ukrainian Armed Forces Special Operations Units.
Yeah, and of course, what Poroshenko is saying is that all of this whole incident has just been fabricated by the Russians. But I'm afraid the evidence is piling up. It's several days now since this took place.
So the FSB were pretty lucky, weren't they, to get these guys?
Well, I don't think they're lucky. They're just good at what they do, Tony. They've had to be. If you're dealing with the kind of people that we're talking about, who carried out the trade union massacre in Odessa and the sniper attack at the beginning of the crisis that was carried out by Pravi sector snipers.
And this comes at the same time as there's actually some reports of big troop build-ups on both sides of the border between Crimea and Ukraine.
Yeah, because, and don't forget that this has become part of the US presidential campaign as well, because Clinton is trying to claim that the Russians have hacked her server, and that's where all these emails have come out about her cheating in the election, and this, it's the Russians who are trying to do this, and we've got to stand up to Russia in Syria, we've got to get rid of Assad, and we've got to arm the Ukrainians. So Obama was in two minds about whether they should be giving more arms to the Ukrainians. Now, in actual fact, we've got a Minsk peace agreement there, which is a basis for an ending of the conflict, and if anybody's got any common sense on all sides, then they will work on that peace agreement. But of course, the right wing in Kiev don't want peace. They never have.
We are Bristol's first community radio station, BCFM 93.2.
We'll go on to the dead bankers now. A list by someone called Michael Tyler. He's a Brit, apparently, from Cambridge, who's blogging about these various dead bankers every time. I think he does an internet search every day to see if any bankers have died, and adds them to his list. But it's a pretty shocking list, Martin. You go through them. He's put a couple of posts on his blog now, which are, they're talking about, on the first one, there's 70. And on the second one, there is another enormous list. I think we're talking about around about 100 altogether. I'll just go through some of the these deaths. Almost all of them actually are suicides, which, I mean, it might just be that being a banker is a very stressful job. And for example, Richard Talley, he died. This is within the last 3 years. A coroner's spokeswoman on Thursday said Talley was found in his garage by a family member who called the authorities. They said Talley died from 7 or 8 self-inflicted wounds from a nail gun fired into his torso and head. And there are references for all this. I'll put a link up on our show page to Michael Tyler's articles. And on the 30th of July, this is a couple of years ago, Julian Knott was 45, was a JP Morgan executive director, Global Tier 3 Network Operations. Wow. Allegedly, he shot his wife multiple times, then he shot himself dead. Then we have Robert Wilson, who was a hedge fund founder, apparent suicide. leapt to his death from his 16th floor residence. Joseph Ambrosio, age 34, financial analyst for JP Morgan, died suddenly from acute respiratory syndrome. Venera Mikhamshrutova, who's a former financial analyst at the Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, he was hit as he was cycling along, just hit by a car and killed. Nick Bagnall, director of the Bank of Tokyo, Mitsubishi, he and his son accidentally killed themselves while they were trying to... Oh, sorry, it was his son. I don't know if it was actually him or his son. Actually killed himself while trying to reenact a Tudor hanging. Amazing. Kieran Tomlin, 39, is a former banker who believed he was being stalked by a reality TV crew. He starved to death in a hotel room after leaving a Do Not Disturb sign on the door for 2 weeks, apparently. Melissa Milan, 54, senior vice president at Mass Mutual Finance Group, stabbed in the chest. She was near a jogging alley in Connecticut. Geert Tak was a private banker for ING, and he managed a portfolio of wealthy clients in Belgium. Cause of death was unknown at the time of the report, but he disappeared in mysterious circumstances after driving his personal car to a garage, from which he took a replacement car to an unknown destination. His body was found in November 2014 near the shores of the Ostend coast. Therese Brouwer, 50, managing director at ING Netherlands. She died in MH17 crash. Apparently, there's been a lot of investigation into that MH17 crash and who really did it and whether there was some motive there too. William Brockschmidt, he was a risk overseer for Deutsche Bank. He was instrumental as a founder of the investment bank, a pioneer of interest rate swaps while at Continental Bank in Chicago. But areas of his Deutsche work were placed under investigation, the UK LIBOR fixing scandal. He was found hanging by his dog's leash in his Kensington flat. Alex Langowitz, the future trader with Merrill Lynch, futures trader, took magic mushrooms with his flatmate and later plunged to his death from his 16th-story Manhattan apartment, Martin. That's just a few of them.
Yeah. And, of course, if you think, as I do, that they've been engaged in criminal activities, that the banks have been engaged in criminal activities for many years, and the danger of that coming out, and the what the consequences of that might be for very powerful people, you can see what the motive might be for these people, lower-level people, to be removed from the situation. That doesn't mean that we are presuming anything, but it's surely suspicious. Surely.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, we move now to have a look at the recent film called The Killings of Tony Blair. With the letter S at the end of Killings is a dollar sign. This has been crowdfunded and is being presented by George Galloway. Great pity that our media can't do this kind of thing. But anyway, let's have a listen now to the first clip, which is looking at the style of government that Tony Blair brought in when he was elected for the first time in 1997.
What we see developing very early in the Blair administration is the kind of tactics that one associates with emperors or rulers of one sort or another who are non-democratic.
They sort of just had a party in which dissent really wasn't tolerated.
No decisions were made in the cabinet. It didn't operate as a cabinet in the way that constitutional theory says it should. People would turn up and it was a sort of little chat. If there was ever anything coming up that he thought you might want to argue about, he'd ask to see you beforehand and try and iron it out. He didn't want any clashing or discussion of ideas and a kind of collective thrashing out of a line. I mean, that it just didn't happen.
Blair had this presidential manner. He ruled by, you know, sofa politics. You picture him and Alistair Campbell leaning back and sort of, you know, their feet up on the desk, deciding the fate of the nation.
The appointment of Alistair Campbell was an acceptance of the brutality and bullying culture that is endemic in Westminster. You know, if Tony didn't want to see you and if you were shown in to see Alistair Campbell, you were going to get a rollicking.
You're going to get monsters.
You were going to get monsters.
Campbell was there with Blair, and he was like the hard guy. Tony was Mr. Charm. Campbell could be rude and rough and swear, and so they were like a duo, Mr. Tough and Mr. Nice, but shoulder to shoulder.
Not only were Mandelson and Campbell the pillars who supported Blair,
and did all his enforcing and his fixing. But they were often used as lightning rods.
Yes.
When things happened, when it was clearly Blair had done something appalling or wrong or stupid, they would step forward and take all the lightning for him and protect him. He was very well protected.
Well, that was Will Self, Ken Livingstone, Claire Short and various others. I'll give a list at all at the end. But also one of the most amazing things is what Blair has done with his career as Prime Minister is he's now making an absolute fortune. But the amazing thing is the British taxpayer is picking up the bill for very much of what he's doing.
Since becoming a multi-millionaire, Blair has also become one of Britain's biggest benefit claimants. First, there's the more than £100,000 he claims as a former Prime Minister to run his private office. And then there's his security detail, costing taxpayers up to £16,000 a week. Eight police officers accompany Blair as he crisscrosses the globe, while others guard his houses.
He is unable to walk down a street in Britain without heavy, heavy police protection. His house here in London is guarded by members of the Metropolitan Tactical Firearms Support Unit 24/7.
I mean, the idea that the public purse is funding Blair's security to run what are, in fact, commercial operations around the world is an outrage.
But he needs an armed guard for a reason.
JP Morgan paid him off for the Iraq war. He was then paid $6 million every year and still is from JP Morgan 6 months after he left office. The man is a war criminal.
Tony Blair!
War criminal!
Tony Blair!
That was the Chilcot report, where some people weren't very happy with Mr. Blair, managed to make a little protest at the time. But then also we have the actual 2003 itself, and where Blair tells us that this is a great opportunity, invading Iraq and getting rid of this evil dictator, to reorder the world.
This is a moment to seize. The kaleidoscope has been shaken. The pieces are in flux. Soon they will settle again. Before they do, let us reorder this world around us.
I think he suddenly saw himself as some sort of warrior in the self-styled war on terror.
This is a battle with only one outcome. Our victory, not theirs.
He changed and became... I'm going to show I'm tough and powerful and important and significant on the world stage. I'll do that by being best friends with the President of the United States.
Blair needed a dose of sanity, but W definitely wasn't the guy to provide it.
Every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or you are with the terrorists.
And I give you, on behalf of our country, our solidarity, our sympathy, and our support.
The special relationship means England is our lieutenant. The fashionable word is partner.
We gotta go.
That's the word they like to hear.
Tony Blair seemed to always be at our president's side, nodding his head and agreeing with whatever policy it was. And I believe he was even called George Bush's poodle for that reason.
Well, as far as I know, The Killings of Tony Blair is not available to watch at the cinema around here, which is a great pity. There's some talk about having screenings, etc. in the city, but it is available as a DVD from theblairdoc.com, theblairdoc.com. Martin, what do you make of it?
They seem to be doing a pretty good job of pointing out the blindingly obvious, which is that Blair is a wrong'un in every possible way that you can imagine.
Do you think he was groomed to be Prime Minister for this sort of specific purpose?
Because
it doesn't... Sound both, like that.
Both he and Gordon Brown went to the US before they were elected as Labour leaders in order to promise the Americans that they would be absolutely on side with whatever they wanted to do. That's how Labour politics works. But, of course, the grassroots of the Labour Party are something else entirely.
Yes, it's an amazing documentary. Very useful, very interesting. Come on, BBC, put it on. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Mahmoud Bukawi is back from the Sudan, is on in a minute. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Labour Councillor for Central Ward, Kai Dudd. Also to Martin Summers there. This our sister show, Dialects, here on BCFM at noon every Tuesday. Thisweek.org.uk takes you straight to this show's links and its archives. You can download our MP3s, your heart's content, listen in the car or anywhere. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 5 next week. And don't let the banksters let you down.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Peter Phillips will join us again next week. On today's program, we're joined by the New York Times bestselling author David Talbot. He is also the founder and editorial director of Hot Books, a new partnership with Skyhorse Publications. And we are joined by two of the new Hot Books authors. First, we're joined by Nicholas Scow. He's author of Spooked, How the CIA Manipulates the Media and Hoodwinks Hollywood. Later in the program, we'll be joined by Hot Books author Alexander Zaitchek. His book, The Gilded Rage, A Wild Ride Through Donald Trump's America. Join us on the Project Censored Show for an hour about Hot Books. Stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Today's program, we look at the best-selling author's latest project, David Talbot. We look at his project called Hot Books. It's a partnership with Skyhorse Publications. Of course, David Talbot is the New York Times best-selling author of The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years. The book's called Brothers. His latest book, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA and the Rise of America's Secret Government. David Talbot joins us by phone to talk about Hot Books today. For the first part of the program, we're also joined by Hot Books author Nicholas Scow. His book, Spooked, How the CIA Manipulates the Media and Hoodwinks Hollywood. So David Talbot and Nick Scow, welcome to the Project Censored Show. David Talbot, let's start with you. Tell us about Hot Books.
Hot Books I started a year ago with Tony Lyons at Skyhorse Publishing. And I come out of a magazine and newspaper background, and I felt that the news hole for serious, deep, investigative journalism was quickly disappearing. And so books to me seemed to be one of the only formats left, at least in print journalism, where you could continue to do that kind of serious work. So I came up with an idea called Hot Books, an imprint dedicated to deep journalism, short format, about 40,000 words, about 120 pages or so, so people could read it pretty quickly and get the information they needed. And I went to some of the most provocative and, I thought, most hard-digging investigative journalists out there to start writing these books for me on the most burning topics. And I'm glad that you're featuring a couple of them today, Mickey.
Yeah, actually, David Talbot, we've certainly perused the list, and you've already had significant publications in this series, including American Nuremberg, The Gilded Rage, which we'll be talking about later on, another book on Snowden and so forth. So definitely something that people should check out, Hot Books. And right now we're also joined by Nick Scow, one of the authors on Hot Books. Nick, your book is Spooked, How the CIA Manipulates the Media and Hoodwinks Hollywood. Given you have a background publishing on CIA and Gary Webb and so forth, it seems like a natural trajectory for you. Tell us about how you sat down and researched this book, Spooked, for David Talbot's Hot Books.
Well, the first thing that I did was read Carl Bernstein's 1977 Rolling Stone article in which he exposed decades of manipulation of the media by the CIA and named all the names of the different newspapers and editors and reporters that were in on this, and realized that really it had been since then, since the story had really been updated. I had some sort of direct experience, as you mentioned, in the 1990s when Gary Webb's story about CIA crack cocaine smuggling was criticized in the press and Gary's work was vilified, and recently, the CIA actually released new information about how it had worked with these media outlets to try to destroy his reputation. So I already had a little bit of a head start, but then I just decided to try to actually talk to as many national security reporters and retired CIA people, including folks like Frank Snapp, who was very helpful in trying to tell the other side of the story about how the CIA manipulates reporters. Because unlike previous times when the CIA directly employed papers and reporters, now they have to basically play reporters off each other and get reporters to do that work for free.
So it's pretty detailed and complex, this world that you're diving into here in this recent book regarding how the CIA manipulates media. And in fact, it's not just the news media that you delve into. And certainly at Project Censored, we look at news media censorship, both corporate media censorship, deep state type censorship. And also we've looked into Hollywood propaganda and propaganda as a form of censorship. So you talk about Hollywood as well. Can you talk about that?
What's interesting is that really since its inception, the CIA had a relationship with Hollywood where it had people working in the different studios that would try to guide films along certain political lines that the CIA wanted to see happen. And so by the 1970s, of course, this relationship had soured quite a bit during the Watergate era, during the Vietnam era. And so it really took until the Clinton era, the 1990s, for the CIA to kind of rehabilitate itself with Hollywood. And it created an office within its public affairs division that worked directly with Hollywood on trying to create scripts.
Entertainment liaison, actually, was one of the titles I recall seeing on the CIA's website.
Yeah, well, the first guy to do it was an officer named Chase Brandon. And so projects like Hunt for Red October and all the other Tom Clancy novels sort of built this relationship and created a string of box office successes that were also portraying the CIA in a much more favorable light than had occurred previously. So now this is pretty much an industry, like a revolving door type situation, where you have all these retired CIA people that kind of farm themselves out to Hollywood and also to increasingly to television. And they try to bring these Hollywood producers and directors and TV show directors and showrunners to Langley, where they meet with people in the CIA. And one of the funny interviews that I did for the book about this topic was with John Kiriakou, a whistleblower. He actually, when he was still with the agency, was talking about just bumping into people like Robert De Niro or Ben Affleck, just walking through the halls like they owned the place. They were given red carpet treatment.
And also Leon Panetta, a former head of the CIA who was just booed at the Democratic Convention for his involvement in the drone war campaign. You have an interesting story, too, Nick, about him in the book as well.
Yeah, well, he was very eager to have James Gandolfini portray him in Zero Dark Thirty, and that, you know, actually met with the stars and directors of that project. And, of course, Zero Dark Thirty is probably the most controversial outcome of this relationship between the CIA and Hollywood, where basically you had a narrative that the CIA wanted to spin to the public, sold via a film project. And despite controversy over how the film depicted torture, which I think in retrospect was a bit of a sideshow, the basic narrative of this cat and mouse game resulting in the, you know, assassination of Osama bin Laden was effectively sold to the public. And this wasn't something that Hollywood came up with. It was given to them by the CIA, and the CIA put a very, very serious role in trying to script that movie along those lines, and that's what everybody believes happened. But Seymour Hersh recently has poked a major hole in that, which the rest of the news media hasn't really effectively followed up on or countered, for that matter, to the extent that he suggested that longtime inside sources with the White House and with the intelligence community knew that bin Laden had been located by a Pakistani intelligence source that just told us where he was.
Again, that's pretty riveting kind of information, the detail and the extent to which the CIA is involved in these narratives. And you know, many of our historic narratives don't just come out of or are not just born out of primary sources or out of the news, but they are born out of so-called entertainment, which seems to have an innocuous facade. But, you know, your chapter, Operation Tinseltown, in the book goes into some detail there. And we did mention a little bit about the Homeland series, the film Zero Dark Thirty. And then there was another one with Ben Affleck, Argo, right? And you have an interesting line in the book where you have a line from former CIA officer Robert Baer, who was talking about Argo and said, Argo had nothing to do with reality. Anybody involved in that operation knows that. What's your reaction to some of the things you discovered when you were researching this?
Bob Baer
You know, it's pretty funny. That guy was very frank about not just ARGA, but also Zero Dark 30. I mean, he's another former intelligence source that I spoke with that didn't believe the official story about the bin Laden assassination. But with ARGA, I mean, again, this is just like really an egregious case where it wasn't just the CIA being reflected as heroes in a Hollywood movie, but Hollywood got to be the hero of that movie as well. So it was kind of a win-win. And it was complete fiction. And that, you know, so people, it's okay to be entertained, obviously, but when you get down to the real kind of nefarious aspect of this working relationship between the CIA and Hollywood, it has to do with providing kind of a veneer of authenticity. So people see shows, even shows that like Homeland, for example, that they know are fictional, they still kind of create this sort of you know, perpetuating myth of the CIA as sort of guardians of our democracy. And despite all the outlandish things that agents like Carrie Matheson, for example, does, you know, the underlying message is we need people like her to do this to protect us from the greater danger of Islamic terrorism, for example, and it keeps the American public on this permanent footing of being afraid of everything.
You know, in a couple books ago, in Censored 2014, Rob Williams wrote a chapter for us called Screening the Homeland, How Hollywood Fantasy Mediates State Fascism in the U.S. of Empire, and he starts it with an epigraph, one that you might recognize. It's from the First Lady of the United States, Michelle Obama, who was beamed in via White House satellite to the Academy Awards in 2013, and said, quote, "Every day our children learn to open their imaginations, to dream just a little bigger. I want to thank all of you tonight for being part of that vitally important work." She's talking about ARGO. Essentially, she's talking about the propaganda efforts of Hollywood.
Basically, the thrust of the chapter that I do is to try to alert the American public to this, because I think that the CIA has completely rehabilitated its relationship with Hollywood and expanded on it in a way that nobody really has focused on. And it's really important for people to realize that all these box office successful movies that are being sold to the public, it's not just entertainment, it's actually propaganda.
And it has real world effect. And that's what I think spooked Nick Scow's book, really drives home for people. And the real life effects are that poll after poll of Americans show that there's wide support for the drone war, immoral, illegal air campaign against, in many cases, civilian populations with civilian casualties. There's wide American support among the public for torture. And now we have the Republican presidential candidate who's openly calling for an escalation of this torture and this carnage in the Middle East. And so Hollywood bears some responsibility, and the media as well, the news media, for laying the groundwork for that kind of public disinformation and public acclaim or support for these very dangerous policies.
Well, in fact, later in the program, David Talbot will be talking with Alexander Zaychek about The Gilded Rage, a book on Trump, so we'll certainly be addressing that later in the program. But David Talbot, let's continue with you for a moment. You wrote the foreword to Nick Scow's book, Spooked, How the CIA Manipulates the Media and Hoodwinks Hollywood. And, of course, you're no stranger to the roots of the CIA and the deep state and the Dulles brothers and so forth. And you certainly are very well aware, as you write in the foreword, about the Rolling Stone article from Carl Bernstein, which Nick has already mentioned. And you're certainly aware of the revelations that come forward through the Pike Commission, the Church Committee, all these things in the 70s. But in your estimation, we heard Nick talking about how the CIA had rehabilitated its relationship since then. Could you talk to us a little bit historically, given your long background looking into the CIA and the deep state, and what do you think has changed in the way that the CIA operates in terms of public manipulation?
Well, it's more subtle, if anything, and Nick goes into how more pervasive in some ways it is and more subtle. In the old days, and look, this goes way back to the beginnings of the CIA in the late 1940s with Alan Dulles, the legendary spy master, and his head of counterintelligence, James Jesus Angleton. These guys were very sophisticated. They knew how important the media was. They knew how important Hollywood was to engage these forces in the culture war. And the culture war was not aimed solely at the Soviet Union and communism, but was aimed at promoting their own power within American democracy. And as Nick says, to give the American people a sense that you need a forceful agency like ours who may cut corners, who may undermine democratic principles or violate the Constitution from time to time, but we will protect you. And so this goes back to the beginning of the agency, where they, through various organizations funded, put enormous amounts of money into magazines, into films, into putting reporters and journalists on their payroll. And to them, this kind of propaganda war was really a front line in their battle. And that sensibility remains very much alive in Langley, CIA headquarters today. Nick talked about how there was a resurgence of their activity in Hollywood in the 90s. Well, I think it's tied directly to the fact that Oliver Stone's film, JFK, that explosive movie that, of course, pointed at the CIA as a prime suspect in the murder of President Kennedy, came out in 1991. And I think the CIA at that point said, this isn't going to happen again. We're not going to have movies like this.
And we actually interviewed Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick, and Stone in particular, about the JFK issue on the 50th anniversary of the assassination. And within a couple of years after that film and the exposure of it, the Congress actually purportedly and allegedly said, well, it's time to have the documents come out. And they passed a provision that said that they were supposed to release the documents, and it hasn't happened still.
Well, thousands of documents were released under the JFK Record Collection Act, and in fact, I used many of those documents in my two books on this brothers about the Kennedy years, and my more recent book about Alan Dulles and the CIA, The Devil's Chessboard. So that was invaluable, and that shows you the power of Hollywood. One movie by Oliver Stone, JFK, had this enormous impact, forced Congress to force the CIA to release many, many of these records. But you're right.
Jefferson Morley, your colleague, is still struggling to get the rest released.
That's right. There's still over 1,500 documents that the CIA illegally, in violation of this law that was passed after Oliver's film came out, is still withholding. We feel that those are key documents that relate to many of the key suspects involved in the Kennedy assassination, the men like William Harvey, who was head of the CIA's assassination unit at the time, and so on. The only thing that will get those records released, those final batch of records, is if there's another big public outcry. And unfortunately, the only times that that happens is when you have a movie like Oliver's film JFK that hits a public nerve.
Indeed. We're speaking with David Talbot. He is New York Times bestselling author of The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government, founder and editorial director of Hot Books, partner with Skyhorse Publications. We're also joined by investigative journalist Nick Scow. His recent book is Spooked, How the CIA Manipulates the Media and Hoodwinks Hollywood. We'll continue our conversation with David Talbot and Nick Scow after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. On today's program, we're featuring Hot Books by David Talbot. This is a partnership with Skyhorse Publications. It's a whole series of very significant books, really kind of old muckraking style journalism. The series of very important topics. We're going to talk with David Talbot here more about some of those books. We are also joined by one of the authors, Nick Scow. His book, Spooked, How the CIA Manipulates the Media and Hoodwinks Hollywood, is the topic for the first part of our show here today. And just before the break, we had mentioned JFK and Oliver Stone came up. And Oliver Stone says of Nick Scow's book, Spooked, Spooked is a concise and convincing essay on the nastiness of the CIA and the power it wields over American media, other government bodies, and in the end, our national perception. That's certainly what we've been talking about. And Nick Scow, let's go to you. Let's talk about another thing that relates to one of your earlier publications. It's hard really to ignore the role Gary Webb plays in the public mind in terms of not only the price that he paid for exposing the CIA and the crack cocaine importation and so forth, 80s, 90s, but also the fact that he was mercilessly attacked by the media that he worked in for so many years. Nick Scow.
As I write in my book, Kill the Messenger, there's never been a case like that before where you had one reporter that was so mercilessly attacked by his colleagues and driven out of journalism ultimately. But I actually had a front row seat to this. And what I remember about Gary's story was that clearly it was incendiary and it was making some very, very powerful allegations about the CIA. And I believe that Gary felt and trusted that other reporters were going to join in the effort of trying to force the CIA
to answer to this and to dig deeper. And so I actually was doing that. I was interviewing former CIA officials that were backing up Gary's reporting. But other reporters clearly went into this with the idea of trying to, as one LA Times editor put it, take away this guy's Pulitzer. I mean, the LA Times in particular was embarrassed by Gary's story. So you had the kind of craven motivation of the competitive press, which played right into the hands of the CIA. The CIA manipulated a press that was already eager to try to attack this guy's work because it hadn't done its job on that story. This was stuff that, I mean, anybody that was, like, sophisticated and around back in the 1980s had been reading stories like this for a long time, but no one had ever really gotten to the bottom of the puzzle of all these people working with the CIA and the drugs that we know were being smuggled into the country, like what specific impact it had. And when Webb put that story into the L.A. Crack epidemic and Freeway Ricky Ross, the most notorious figure in that whole era, this was just a huge embarrassment because the media completely screwed that job up. And it was stuff that the CIA all along was denying. And as a result of Gary's work, despite the fact that he paid the ultimate price for it, the CIA was forced to finally acknowledge for the first time ever that it had an official policy of not informing the Justice Department about criminal activities by Central American anti-communist that was working with, and that it basically buried up, you know, 15 plus years worth of drug smuggling by its assets. And Mickey, if I could just jump in.
Yes, David Talbot.
I think the whole shameful episode of Gary Webb, this brave investigative journalist who was basically crushed by his own colleagues at the behest, I believe, of the CIA, and Nick Scow tells the story so compellingly in his book, Kill the Messenger, which was made into a movie which I think every American should see. I think it's one of the best movies ever made about journalism, starring Jeremy Renner as Gary Webb. And guess what? The movie was not really widely seen. It kind of disappeared. Nick could go into some of the reasons why. But it seems like the few films that do come out that are critical of the national security establishment just don't get the kind of marketing push that films like Zero Dark Thirty do. But this is why, when you see what the LA Times did, the Washington Post did, the New York Times did to Gary Webb, a colleague who had more guts than any of their reporters to explore the story, and as Nick said, out of professional jealousy, and I think out of sort of obedience to the CIA. They rely on the CIA, these people, for the leaks, the sources, the information that really builds their careers. So these people form a kind of unholy partnership, the national security press and the national security agencies. But because of that, that's why we need things like Project Censored and Pacifica Radio and certainly Hot Books. Because there are a few outlets where journalists with integrity can continue to tell the truth, but they're few and far between. Democracy Now, of course, and Salon and The Nation and so on. But we really need to, as readers, as citizens, as listeners, support these institutions that are vital, because you see how the media, the corporate media, works hand in hand with power all too often to stifle the truth.
Indeed, David Talbot, and you can learn more at skyhorsepublishing.com. Do you have another source for Hot Books directly?
Well, my Facebook. I'm in there every day talking about our Hot Books, David Talbot and Facebook. So that's a good page, too, to keep up to date.
David Talbot, you talk about corporate media and their sort of unholy alliance, right? That's kind of almost going back to Lincoln Steffens and 100 years ago in the early muckraking days, talking about the relationships between big business and banks and politicians and inside government. And, of course, our mutual colleague and friend Peter Dale Scott has long written about this. And Nick Scow, you have Peter Dale Scott mentioned in the book here. And he really hits on the line here. And, of course, one of his recent books, The American Deep State, Peter Dale Scott talks about the subtlety that goes on here. And he says the CIA nowadays doesn't really have to buy journalists. Journalists step into line voluntarily to be eligible for promotion, have good relations inside the government, and they are selected for promotion based on their willingness to accept government lies. Nick Scow.
That's a through line in the book that I traced. You know, Gary Webb obviously is the most egregious example of this, but there's so many others. I think a really interesting anecdote from the book involved Bob Perry, who broke some of the first Iran-Contra stories. And again, like Webb, was severely attacked. Perry was effectively told at the Associated Press, you can't do this kind of reporting anymore. He ended up quitting his job at the Associated Press, going over to Newsweek, only to realize he had jumped from the frying pan straight into the fire and was even more vulnerable and was completely taken off the Iran-Contra beat. In fact, Newsweek refused to even cover the Iran-Contra hearings. They just didn't consider it news. And, of course, on the board of directors of these papers are people that, you know, are very chummy with the elite of Washington, D.C. political circles and the intelligence community as well. These are people that have the same worldview, the same political ideology, and there's no place for aggressive, independent investigative reporting in their worldview.
And Nick Scow, you mentioned perception management. We have a chapter forthcoming, a couple chapters actually, in our 40th anniversary book coming out this fall, Project Censored 2017. One on CIA media and the mighty Wurlitzer, but the other by Peter Phillips is about public relations firms worldwide and the three major ones, WPP, one of them, also Hill and Knowlton. And these PR organizations, Hill and Knowlton includes the CIA as one of their clients.
What you see with perception management in the 1980s was effectively the beginning of a process of reconquering control over the press through different means. I mean, in today's climate, you just have so much more of a nefarious relationship between intelligence agencies and the newspapers and television networks that provide the news that it's impossible to actually know where these stories come from. Another aspect of perception management that's now very mainstream is just crafting stories for public consumption. So you have newspapers that are printing stories that are specifically targeted at different demographics to try to make people support political objectives that are not in the interests of our democracy.
No, indeed. And David Talbot, let's go back to you on just that general theme of perception management. I believe it's a fair characterization to say that what you're doing at Hotbooks is really a counter-narrative to this. It's to really tip the balance or gain some type of balance in the world of perception management that tries to, with really great traditional muckraking kind of journalism and reporting, to try to tell the people, as George Seldes said, what's actually going on in the corridors of power in our society.
That's right, Mickey. And let me just quickly run down some. Dee Watkins, a young African-American writer out of Baltimore who wrote about his incredible upbringing, clawing his way up through the drug trade and finally through John Hopkins and become a terrific mentor now and writer. Dee Watkins, his book is called The Beast Side, which is what they call the East Side of Baltimore, Living and Dying While Black in America. We had an amazing book by a military whistleblower, Joe Hickman, a brave guy who ran a security unit at Guantanamo and was a whistleblower there for an earlier book. And he wrote a book called The Burn Pits, which I think is emerging as the Agent Orange scandal of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So you have thousands of GIs coming home from those wars, having been exposed to these open-air burn pits where they literally torched everything, all the garbage that is accumulated by war, including old WMD, including tires and medical waste and all sorts of things. And we feel, he makes a case that Beau Biden, the vice president's son, who was exposed to some of these terrible contaminants while he was serving in Iraq, might have well have been one of the victims of the burn pits. They're terrible clusters of cancer and respiratory disease as a result of this pollution that the soldiers there were forced to breathe 24/7. We have another book you mentioned by philosophy professor in San Francisco at the University of San Francisco, Rebecca Gordon, called American Nuremberg. It's a very reasoned and well thought out case for why dozens of American officials, civilian and military, should be held accountable, just like Nuremberg trials after World War II, for war crimes as a result of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, from Presidents Obama and Bush on down. It's a very provocative book. We had a book that was a companion book to The Hunting Ground, the explosive documentary about the rape crisis on campus, and of course Nick Scow's book and the book we're going to be talking about later about the heart of the Trump campaign. Who are these people are supporting Trump, who feel desperate that they have to do that? So these are books that are, I think, essential to provoke the kind of debates that we need about America these days. And guess what? They're not getting reviewed by the New York Times or the Washington Post. It's very difficult to get our authors on MSNBC or CNN and all of that. Nick, as you can tell, is an incredibly articulate and interesting reporter with a lot of information that is vital for people to hear. And thank God, as I said, for radio shows like your own and Pacifica Radio and other stations. But this is really a culture war. We're in the trenches. And while Bill O'Reilly and his books and those kind of right-wing books go immediately to the bestseller list because of the huge right-wing media juggernaut that they have at their disposal.
A whole slew of them just recently.
Yeah, there are four on the bestseller. The top four books on the bestseller list now are all far-right books. So, you know, the progressives really have to build their own kind of amplification system, their own megaphone system to spread the word about films, books, art exhibits that really are trying to tell the truth. And it's up to all of us to do that.
Indeed. And Nick Scow, I want to conclude this segment with you. And I want to say that I think this book, Spooked, How the CIA Manipulates the Media and Hoodwinks Hollywood, is really essential reading. I think if people really want to start to understand the degree to which information is managed and controlled in various outlets, this is a fantastic primer, and it's a quick read as well. Again, I can't help but draw connections to the chapter we'll have in Censored 2017 on the mighty Wurlitzer. But this is such very important work, Nick Scow. It's an honor to have you on the program. You end the book by talking about a few different examples post 9/11. You're talking about Mark Mazzetti in particular, at one of the reporters. And but you kind of highlight how the CIA manipulates sort of media and journalists even to pit them against each other and to scoop things. You have a quote from John Lindsay over at McClatchy Papers. Could you talk a little bit about some of that, again, more subtle scooping and how that's working to manipulate public opinion?
A very rare thing that Spooked is able to do is to actually get people that are still doing national security reporting to talk about the kind of dirty details of it and how the CIA tries to play them off each other and all the risks that are involved in trying to actually get to the truth. And so Mark Mazzetti, for example, he told me flat out that on any particular story he's working on, he feels like maybe he's lucky if he knows about 20% of the facts. And the CIA is not there to do anything other than to try to keep him from being able to do his job. And to the extent that, for example, he was trying to report on drone strikes, he was always under the pressure of not being able to get any real information from the CIA. And, of course, he and many other people had been covering the drone campaigns and knew, for example, the guy who was in charge of it, a person named Michael D'Andrea, for example, who was a character in Zero Dark Thirty. Everybody knew this guy who was a strange, strange dude. And so there were even articles that the Washington Post would put out just talking about this mysterious Muslim convert that ran the drone campaign. But, I mean, this guy had a much darker history. He was involved with the torture program. He had been involved with losing track of the 9/11 hijackers. And basically all these guys are part of this club where they're able to get certain stories out there. But in order to do their job, they have to hold back. And they also have editors that are always kind of putting the brakes on their reporting. So they never actually exposed this guy. They never really told the full story of who he was or how dangerous this guy was, who was in such a powerful position at the CIA, until after the CIA basically fired him for botching a drone strike that resulted in two Western hostages being killed in a building that we bombed without any idea who was inside it. It just fit this vague criteria, which we use in Pakistan, of being eligible target if we find it suspicious.
Well, Nick Scow, I'm hoping that people pick up your latest book, How the CIA Manipulates the Media and Hoodwinks Hollywood. John Kuriakow says Nick Scow, Spooked, doesn't just crack open the door on the CIA's iron grip on journalism, television, and films. It blows that door wide open. This book is a public service, and it serves as a warning about CIA control of so many facets of our everyday lives. That's former CIA person John Kuriakow, who did prison time for outing Bush's torture program. Nick Scow, Spooked, How the CIA Manipulates the Media and Hoodwinks Hollywood. Thank you so much for joining the Project Censored show today.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. We're joined today for the hour by David Talbot. He is the founder and editorial director of Hot Books, a partnership with Skyhorse. We were just speaking with author Nicholas Scow about Spooked, How the CIA Manipulates Media and Hoodwinks Hollywood. On the next segment of the program, we're joined by another Hot Books author, Alexander Zaitchek. His book, The Gilded Rage, A Wild Ride Through Donald Trump's America. We'll continue that conversation after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. For today's program, we're speaking with David Talbot, who is the founder and editorial director of Hot Books, a partnership with Skyhorse that's been releasing a series of investigative journalistic-style muckraking books on very important and key issues. And David Talbot continues with us for this part of the program. We're also joined by Hot Books author Alexander Zajcik. His book out on Hot Books, which just came out August 16th, is called The Gilded Rage, A Wild Ride Through Donald Trump's America. So we're going to be speaking with Alex about his book and his experience traveling around the country very recently, talking not about Donald Trump so much as talking with the people that the Trump candidacy has seemed to spark or seemed to embolden. But before we talk with Alex, we're going to go back to David Talbot. David Talbot, just for this segment, please again remind our listeners about Hot Books and what you're trying to do with this series.
Hot Books is a new startup, a scrappy new imprint in partnership with Skyhorse Books in New York. And we're trying to put out short books, about 40,000 words each, on the most burning topics in America, whether that's war crimes or Donald Trump or how U.S. intelligence manipulates the news in Hollywood, as we were discussing earlier. These are books that seldom, the topics, get really investigated deeply enough by the corporate media. And Hot Books is trying to put these kind of burning subjects in front of people to have the national debates that this country so urgently needs.
Indeed, and we're joined by author Alexander Zajcik. Alex grew up around Boston, started writing for zines as a teenager in the early 1990s. Alex has reported from around the world for dozens of newspapers, websites, magazines, and his new book about Trump supporters has come out on Hot Books, and it's titled The Gilded Rage, A Wild Ride Through Donald Trump's America. So, Alexander Zajcik, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Great to be here.
Alex, tell us about this book. You know, I can't help but see a little Hunter S. Thompson in there and a little more narrative-style journalism where you went out and traveled around the country for a few months and you actually wanted to talk to people that were self-proclaimed Trump supporters, and you wanted to kind of find out what was going on behind not just the Trump campaign, but behind this movement of people, sort of what's at least being displayed in the corporate media as a sometimes right-wing populist movement. But talk to us about what propelled you to do this, and let's talk more in detail about how it happened.
Like a lot of people, I was surprised and a little bit confused by Trump's early success in the primary. And I watched with a little bit of alarm, like a lot of people, when it became clear that he was probably going to run away with the nomination. And I wasn't sure what was behind this, so I hit the road to try to find out. The media tried to answer this question. You know, there was no shortage of articles saying, here's all you need to know to explain the Trump phenomenon, meet the Trump voter, meet this person or that person. But none of these pieces made me feel like I'd met anybody. You know, they'd get two lines, they'd get a 10-second soundbite, or there would be some sort of description of them by someone in the pundit class or some beat reporter covering politics from Washington. So I decided to do what people weren't doing, which was actually talk to people in their communities and let them explain themselves and their lives in their own words and try to get at politics, not necessarily directly by asking them about this or that policy platform that Trump may espouse, but more about what it's like to grow up and live and work in their corner of the country. And I tried to focus on corners of the country that weren't used to heavy media attention. I focused on three regions primarily that were symbolically resonant with the Trump campaign: the Rust Belt, Appalachia, and the border. And I tried to find places in those areas where people were and the media wasn't.
Alex Zajcik, I'm a big fan of epigraphs, and you've got some great ones here. And you quote Max Brooks from World War Z: the more those elitist eggheads shouted, "The dead are walking," the more most real Americans tuned them out. Was that your experience when you were researching the book?
Yeah, I mean, that was a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek
epigraph. Indeed.
But yeah, I mean, I think it does get an important element of this story, and that is this sense of resentment and opposition with regard to the media class and elites generally, anything associated with what we've come to understand as the establishment. And that's true on both sides of this election. I mean, you saw it in the Sanders phenomenon, and if you're a conservative coming out of a more right-leaning place and you're used to a different kind of language and politics, then your anti-establishment vote was probably going to go to Donald Trump. I mean, there was no shortage of candidates that represented kind of same old, either Koch brothers-connected corporate Republican lobbying universe. There was plenty of choice on that side, but people obviously want something different. And the more people told them they were insane or stupid for doing so, the more it kind of fueled in to this sense that this was their kind of revenge, and that they were going to do what they want, and they were going to have a voice outside of what people were telling them to do.
Well, indeed, and you begin the book, Gilded Rage, great title, by the way, and you say, who are these people? And that's a fantastic question, because we've seen a lot of polls, we've seen various studies, we've seen people arguing about, well, what is the Trump phenomenon, and so on and so forth. And even most recently, we've seen people like Michael Moore talking about how it's, you know, again, sort of like the great American reality TV show, some election edition, where Trump is almost a built-in foil for the Clinton Foundation. So it's been a pretty wild ride. But I think what struck me about your book is that you really went to parts of the country where people often are ignored or taken for granted in terms of political demographics. But tell us a little bit about, what did you find when you were talking to these people?
Anytime you really talk to someone, I think that you have a preconceived notion about, you're going to find that these stereotypes and especially caricatures don't survive all that long. And with regard to Trump supporters, we've been given a pretty steady diet of those stereotypes, and some of them are grounded in things that are real enough. I mean, the footage from the rallies, the violence, you should not discount that. I don't discount any of those images, and it's natural that they would build up a mental picture. But what I found out talking to people, getting people away from sort of heated, confrontational rally environments, was that the picture was more often than not much more complicated than the sort of angry, red-faced, kind of scowling racist Trump voter.
And you interviewed a lot of people, and the thing, again, that I point out about your book is that you have people in their own voice.
Yeah. And what they say in their own voices is often quite surprising. I was not expecting to find the level of self-awareness that I often encountered with regard to Trump and his shortcomings, and also the self-awareness about their own draw, how they're drawn to those shortcomings and some of the things Trump says. Maybe they're not only not sold on these things, but they're disappointed in themselves for responding to them. And there's a level of critical thinking, I think, in the average Trump supporter that, well, I won't say the average Trump supporter. I'm not going to speak for 13 million people and create an alternative stereotype. I would just say within that 13 million people, you're going to find a lot of surprises and people who are not as uncritically fanatical.
But can I just jump in? And what Alex has done here is a remarkable job of bringing these people to life. There's these human portraits of people where Alex goes to a bar and drinks with a veteran or hangs out with people at their home and so on. And what you get is a sense of their humanity and their legitimate rage and bitterness. These are people who fought for their country, or soldiers who are returning home, who were used up by the military-industrial complex and thrown away. The same with the corporate system, the coal mining industry, and other industries that have just used these people and thrown them away. And the government and corporate America have found no ways to re-educate these people and give them new skills. And so these are the refuse of American society. And it was only a matter of time before someone like a fake populist like Donald Trump, the gilded populist, to use Alex's term, would come along and begin to exploit this. I mean, now his new campaign manager, this guy Steve Bannon out of Breitbart, tries to present himself as this great populist, and he's an ex-Goldman Sachs guy. But he lets Cook, the CEO of Apple, have it for taking jobs overseas and hiding taxes overseas, and people say right on to that. And, you know, Apple, of course, is the great darling of the liberal elite, but they are ripping off the American people, and they're ripping off American workers. And let's say, frankly, look, journalists I know, including myself, are paycheck to paycheck, frankly. We just hang on, you know? I mean, I start these little businesses and all that, and Alec gets his books published, but he's like sleeping on people's couches while he goes across the country interviewing these people. You know, if you're a progressive working journalist and you haven't sold out and you're not working for CNN or working for some big Washington think tank, then you're day-to-day, like a lot of these people. So I think Alec's empathy comes from the fact that he can genuinely feel their pain.
Yeah, Alex Achick, let's bring you back in, author of The Gilded Rage, Wild Ride Through Trump's America. You mentioned earlier that you go through different regions, and you actually began with who are these people. You go through Arizona, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, New Mexico, California, and again, reading these narratives, reading these people is again, it's an eye-opening experience. Let's take Wisconsin for an example, since you write about it in the book. Wisconsin has been in the media the last few years because of this kind of right-wing resurgence, right? This governor, there's a lot of conservative and right-wing ideological energy kind of emanating out of places like Wisconsin. And you interviewed folks that say some pretty interesting things that you don't hear a lot about, and that includes veterans. Right. I served in Kuwait during Operation Desert Storm. We shouldn't have been there. Same with Iraq in 2003. And then they go and then they'll attach that to something that Trump says where they believe he's correct about some of the things that come out of his mouth.
Yeah. Wisconsin is actually one of the few states that Trump lost by a significant margin. But still, there were a sizable number of people who passed votes for him. And a lot of the people I spoke with at the Trump rallies were vets who were quite embittered about both the wars and also the experience that they've had upon returning, dealing with the VA, which they consider underfunded and dysfunctional.
This is, again, why I urge people to check out The Gilded Rage. You can read these stories. One of the people in this segment says, I believe in a nice minimum wage, maybe $10, but the more you go up, the more you're shooting yourself in the foot. Watch what happens in California. And Billy's making $15 at McDonald's, but G.I. Joe's only making $9. If you join the service right now, you're making $9.25 an hour. He's defending our country wearing a helmet and a gun, but Billy, who never graduated high school, is making $15 flipping a burger. That's a very real perspective for people in that situation.
And that's a recurring motif, references to the military. I encountered that a lot. There were a lot of things I noticed that came up a lot more than I expected. For example, opioid addiction. No matter where I was, people talked about how with the loss of industry and the loss of stable, often unionized deployment, you had drug use they never expected to see, and kinds of drugs at rates that they're just shocking, especially in Pennsylvania and West Virginia. I was in places that were 60-70% of the young people were on pills or smack. It reported on in the states, especially in New England and places where people maybe didn't expect to see it, but at the depth of it and how broad this crisis is was quite surprising to me, and it came up again and again when people were explaining why they were supporting Trump and trying to probe their own sense of desperation. They're like, I'm seeing things in my community that are just heartbreaking to me, and I don't know what's going on. And, of course, Trump has no answers for this stuff. He blames Mexican mafia cartels when it's Big Pharma who's basically triggered this crisis, the overabundance of pills and prescriptions. But, again, they always bring it back to the economy. They said the jobs came back, good union jobs, although Trump, again, doesn't talk about unions. Tells you how serious he is about this stuff and his industrial policy. But they know somehow it comes back, the good jobs they knew growing up that don't seem to be around anymore.
And they're not coming back, and it's people like Donald Trump that have outsourced a lot of those kinds of jobs. But Alexander Zaychek, there's some irony there, given that people like Trump have outsourced these jobs, and you even referenced Thomas Frank in the beginning of the book, What's the Matter with Kansas? I mean, how much did you see of that happening, or how much self-realization that you mentioned earlier?
Sure, it's more than an irony. I mean, it's sad. This guy is able to convince people that he's the answer when, in fact, you know, as David alluded to, he's a phony, clearly, and his interests are, I believe, elsewhere. But there's a sense that he's at least speaking the language, and they don't know that it's worth rolling the dice, that he, you know, says he's going to be some kind of traitor to his class, and he's going to think about the little guy and try to get these companies back, whether he has to personally browbeat every CEO in the country. I mean, it's absurd. But if you got no other hopes, if it's that or Paul Ryan, maybe this is worth a shot. So goes the thinking. And that's what I heard again and again. So there is a self-realization that he could be a phony and a fraud. And they know that he's a rich guy who makes his ties in China. Like, a lot of them do know that. But they figure, you know, FDR grew up with a silver spoon in his mouth, too. And look what happened. I mean, they didn't usually allude to FDR, but that's the same kind of hope.
So we're speaking with Alexander Zaychek. He is author of The Gilded Rage, Wild Ride Through Donald Trump's America. We're also joined by David Talbot. He is the founder and editorial director of Hot Books, and this is one of the hot books that David Talbot has published. When we come back, we'll talk more with Alexander Zaychek about The Gilded Rage. You're tuned to Pacifica Radio. This is the Project Censored Show, and I'm Mickey Huff. After this brief musical break, we'll continue our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Today's show, we're looking at the Hot Books series that David Talbot is behind in partnership with Skyhorse. David Talbot has put a lot of effort into this new series, Hot Books, and we were speaking earlier in the program with Nick Scow on his book, Spooked, How the CIA Manipulates the Media and Hoodwinks Hollywood. We are now joined by Alexander Zaitchek. He is author of The Gilded Rage, that looks at the Trump supporters in the United States by going and actually milling around and talking with them and spending a lot of time with them several months in various regions of the U.S. Before the break, we were talking a bit about Trump, the candidate, or Trump, the person himself. And you write, Alex Zaitchek, in your book, like Jeff Goldblum in The Fly, Trump entered the race having completed a dangerous experimental mutation from gossip page guppy and Playboy developer to a new breed of right-wing populist. Equal parts Howard Stern and Michael Savage, Tony Robbins and Father Coughlin, Kim Kardashian and Benito Mussolini. Again, this is the kind of writing that really drew me into the book and the style of the presentation. And you write, the pundits and pollsters assured us the experiment would fail, that this 200-pound insect man bioengineered by Joe McCarthy's old lawyer would be dead within weeks. Well, where are we, Alex Zaitchek? That didn't happen.
No, he ran away with the nomination, and it's looking less and less likely that he's going to be our next president. But I think the lesson of the primary season still stands, and I don't think the Republican Party is going to resemble itself pre-Trump anytime soon. So where are we? I think we're sort of in a situation where we need to figure out a way to speak with Trump voters. And when I say we, I mean anyone interested in broader and deeper progressive movement that includes everyone, including poor uneducated whites, who we may want to write off as racists because it's a little bit easier, frankly, than engaging with the divides that are there and not always easy to overcome. But it has to be done. Otherwise, what we're going to see is more ethno-nationalism feeding off of anger, despair, and more Donald Trumps, probably better polished, smarter Donald Trumps, who actually want things besides their ego to be fed and stroked. And those are the ones we really need to worry about coming down the pike in the coming years.
I just want to reiterate with Alex, which I think is really important for all your listeners to grapple with, which is, yeah, okay, Donald Trump may be flaming out here, and maybe we can breathe a sigh of relief about that, but not really, because what he exposed to America was this huge mass of people who are deeply disgruntled, who are deeply desperate, and he may leave the political scene, but look, Steve Bannon and his Breitbart organization, another weird ex-Goldman Sachs populist, who has just been named CEO of the Trump campaign, you know, could very well represent the future of the Republican Party. The so-called alt-right is now taking over the Republican Party. It's a dangerous sort of, I think, mix of philosophies and ideologies. You know, it's racist, it's anti-Muslim, it's anti-immigrant, but it's kind of strangely pro-gay in some ways and has some, progressive elements as well. It's a weird mixture. It's kind of like fascism 2.0, I think. So we do have to be concerned about the Trump constituency, even if we don't have to be concerned about Trump himself after November.
Alex Zaitchek, perhaps your next book is The Gilded Rage, Take Two, going through the Sanders camp, taking a look at what's going on inside of the Democratic Party, which has basically abandoned any kind of, you know, populism in a progressive sense from 100 years ago.
Yeah, it's not a pretty picture at the moment.
Well, when you were traveling around and speaking to these people, what kind of impressions were you getting from some of these folks about Democrats, particularly the Clinton-style Democrats?
Certainly nothing positive about Hillary Clinton or the corporatist Democratic Party. It was basically among Trump supporters grouped in with the sort of corporatist Republican Party. They were pretty sharp-eyed on that. As for the Sanders insurgency, there was a lot of sympathy with big aspects of it, particularly the criticism of Wall Street. You know, I met a lot of Trump supporters who were open to the idea of some sort of universal health care, even, you know, free or subsidized education. But there are some very deep cultural cleavages in this country that stop people from being able to support a self-declared socialist. These are people who grew up in the Cold War, who listened to the talk radio for decades, and they've been pounded with this idea that there's no such thing as free. Free, it doesn't mean free, and they've not just gotten it from
Rush Limbaugh. They've gotten it from their fathers and their grandfathers. So the challenge is to communicate a Sanders-like agenda without the ethno-nationalist impulses and connotations of a Trump campaign while somehow addressing these messaging hurdles. It's not going to happen overnight, but there has to be a way to do it. And that's one of the things I kept finding myself thinking about in these conversations, because there was often a surprising amount of common ground, but they just couldn't get around certain things, which sometimes were just a matter of language.
That's a pretty interesting point. And I do want to go back to the so-called Rust Belt. I had mentioned one of the longstanding congressmen there who died not too long ago, but actually was jailed for corruption. That would be Jim Trafficant. And I did bring him up because Donald Trump was just recently in Ohio, spoke at Youngstown State University. And Youngstown is kind of the poster child for Rust Belt depression and, you know, what happened to Youngstown when the steel mills closed. And you get a lot of the same kind of talk coming out of West Virginia and people about coal mines and these kind of things. And it's interesting that there's a history there of people that were union, so they were affiliated with the Democratic Party. But again, on many social issues, they were actually incredibly conservative. So that's something that you saw on the road as well.
Yeah, there was a lot of conservative Democrats in Pennsylvania, Western Pennsylvania, West Virginia, who were voting Trump, and some movement in the other direction as well. But I was more interested in those who were moving over to Trump. And the sense that the Democrats are anti-coal, which of course is related to anti-steel, steel, coke, and coal are all very much related in that region, is something that they can't really get past. And, you know, if that's your economy and that's your livelihood and that's been your family's livelihood for as long as you can remember, maybe you shouldn't get past it until the Democrats come up with a very serious, extremely well-funded jobs and retraining program for the region. And Democrats have made noises in that direction, but I think they need to make a lot more effort in that area.
Well, Alex Acheck, among the Trump supporters that you encountered, could you give us some kind of maybe an overview or an assessment of what did some of these people have to say about women's issues or feminist issues vis-a-vis the Trump campaign?
Nobody seems terribly concerned about the heavy odor of sexism, let us say, that hangs around the Trump campaign. That I'm not going to try to sugarcoat at all. I mean, it's just shot through and through, and it's a different world that these people, and including the women of the Trump campaign, I spoke with them, and they're like, just kind of laugh this stuff off. And they didn't try to deny it necessarily. I would say the other big ism that everyone wants to know about, racism, is something that was much more a sensitive issue. And when it was brought up, they frequently became angry. In their mind, the whole PC thing, the whole hurling of the racist epithet is just a way of disqualifying them and their whole culture and everything about them. And they think it's unfair. And very frequently, after getting to know some of these people, I can tell you it is unfair. The people who were voting for Donald Trump were not, in every case, racist by any means. Does that mean that there's no racism in the Trump phenomenon? Absolutely not. It's sort of marbleized. It's streaked through. But the idea that you can quantify it or say it measures this much and therefore, you know, draw conclusions that are neat and packageable, I don't know. It's a tough one. But I do not think that it's the primary driver. I mean, I was open to that conclusion when I started my research, but I have to abide by my findings, and I really don't think this is primarily a white ethno-nationalist movement. I think that the economic anxieties are much more important than the racial hang-ups and anxieties that are also co-present and, as I said, streaked through. I mean, I just have talked to too many people over too many hours and gotten people to have their guard down too much to think that's all that's going on here. And again, I didn't go to the Deep South. I did stick to six states in the regions I mentioned. So I'm not claiming, again, to know 13 million souls. But what I found does not line up with this sort of easy media stereotype of a racist vanguard. And that's all this is. I think a lot of people want to believe that because, quite frankly, it lets everyone off the hook. Just a bunch of racist yahoos. Close the book.
Zaitchek's newest book, The Gilded Rage, A Wild Ride Through Donald Trump's America. You can learn more at Zaitchek.com. That's Zaitchik.com. And we've also been joined for the hour by David Talbot. He is founder and editorial director of Hot Books in partnership with Skyhorse. You can learn more about Skyhorse at skyhorsepublishing.com. And David Talbot said earlier you could find him on Facebook, and you'll see him promoting many of the Hot Books. And we certainly intend to have more Hot Books authors on the Project Censored show. So, Alexander Zaychek, thank you for your latest work, and thank you for joining us on the Project Censored show today.
You're welcome. Thanks so much.
David Talbot, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Mickey. It's been a pleasure.
TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness.
Project for the New American Century.
You are about to hear the second of a two-part reading of an extraordinary document by the Project for the New American Century. No less than a blueprint for U.S. military world rule. In part one, the need for the U.S. to fight and win multiple large-scale wars and to maintain police forces across the globe was spelled out. In order to convince the American public to support these policies, the authors say that a new Pearl Harbor would be needed to speed up the transformation of the U.S. military into a global strike force. A year after the document was written, the events of 9/11 became that catastrophic and catalyzing event. Today's reading begins with a reference to Pearl Harbor.
You are listening to excerpts from Rebuilding America's Defenses, Strategy, Forces, and Resources for a New Century, produced by the Project for the New American Century. Creating Tomorrow's Dominant Force. To preserve American military preeminence in the coming decades, the Department of Defense must move more aggressively to experiment with new technologies and operational concepts and seek to exploit the emerging revolution in military affairs. Information technologies, in particular, are becoming more prevalent and significant components of modern military systems. These information technologies are having the same kind of transforming effects on military affairs as they are having in the larger world. The effects of military transformation will have profound implications for how wars are fought, what kinds of weapons will dominate the battlefield, and, inevitably, which nations enjoy military preeminence. The United States enjoys every prospect of leading this transformation. Indeed, it was the improvement in capabilities acquired during the American defense buildup of the 1980s that hinted at and then confirmed during Operation Desert Storm that a revolution in military affairs was at hand. Further, the process of transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. In general, to maintain American military preeminence that is consistent with the requirements of a strategy of American global leadership, tomorrow's U.S. armed forces must meet two new missions. Global missile defenses, a network against limited strikes capable of protecting the United States, its allies, and forward-deployed forces, must be constructed. This must be a layered system of land, sea, air and space-based components. Control of space and cyberspace, much as control of the high seas and the protection of international commerce, defined global powers in the past, so will control of the new international commons be a key to world power in the future. An America incapable of protecting its interests or that of its allies in space or the infosphere will find it difficult to exert global political leadership. Missile defenses. Effective ballistic missile defenses will be the central element in the exercise of American power and the projection of U.S. military forces abroad. Without it, weak states operating small arsenals of crude ballistic missiles armed with basic nuclear warheads or other weapons of mass destruction will be in a strong position to deter the United States from using conventional force, no matter the technological or other advantages we may enjoy, even if such enemies are merely able to threaten American allies rather than the United States homeland itself, America's ability to project power will be deeply compromised. Creating a system of global missile defenses is but the first task of transformation. The need to reshape U.S. conventional forces is almost as pressing. For although American armed forces possess capabilities and enjoy advantages that far surpass those of even our richest and closest allies, let alone our declared and potential enemies, the combination of technological and strategic change that marks the new century places these advantages at risk. Today's U.S. conventional forces are masters of a mature paradigm of warfare marked by the dominance of armored vehicles, aircraft carriers, and especially manned tactical aircraft that is beginning to be overtaken by a new paradigm marked by long-range precision strikes and the proliferation of missile technologies. Ever since the Persian Gulf War of 1991, when an Iraqi Scud missile hit the Saudi warehouse in which American soldiers were sleeping, causing the largest single number of casualties in the war, when Israeli and Saudi citizens donned gas masks in nightly terror of Scud attacks, the value of the ballistic missile has been clear to America's adversaries. When their missiles are tipped with warheads carrying nuclear, biological, or chemical weapons, even weak regional powers have a credible deterrent, regardless of the balance of conventional forces. That is why, according to the CIA, a number of regimes, North Korea, Iraq, Iran, Libya, and Syria, quote, already have or are developing ballistic missiles, unquote, that could threaten U.S. allies and forces abroad. To increase their effectiveness, ground-based interceptors like the Army's Theater High Altitude Area Defense System must be networked to space-based systems, space and cyberspace. No system of missile defenses can be fully effective without placing sensors and weapons in space. Although this would appear to be creating a potential new theater of warfare, in fact, space has been militarized for the better part of four decades. Weather, communications, navigation, and reconnaissance satellites are increasingly essential elements in American military power. Indeed, U.S. armed forces are uniquely dependent upon space. As the 1996 Joint Strategy Review, a precursor to the 1997 Quadrennial Defense Review, concluded, quote, space is already inextricably linked to military operations on land, on the sea, and in the air, unquote. The report of the National Defense Panel agreed. Unrestricted use of space has become a major strategic interest of the United States. As exemplified by the global positioning satellite, space has become a new international commons where commercial and security interests are intertwined. Many of these commercial space systems have direct military applications, including information from global positioning system constellations and better than 1 meter resolution imaging satellites. Indeed, 95% of current U.S. military communications are carried over commercial circuits, including commercial communications satellites. Space control is not an avoidable issue. It is not an optional extra. For U.S. armed forces to continue to assert military preeminence, control of space defined by the Space Command, as access to space, freedom of operations within the space medium, and an ability to deny others the use of space must be an essential element of our military strategy. Yet, it will not merely be enough to protect friendly commercial uses of space. As Space Command also recognizes, the United States must also have the capability to deny America's adversaries the use of commercial space platforms for military purposes in times of crisis and conflicts. As outlined by Space Command, carrying out this program would include a mix of reusable and expendable launch vehicles and vehicles that can operate within space, including space tugs to deploy, reconstitute, replenish, refurbish, augment, and sustain space systems. But over the long term, maintaining control of space will inevitably require the application of force both in space and from space. Cyberspace, or net war. If outer space represents an emerging medium of warfare, then cyberspace, and in particular the Internet, holds similar promise and threat. As with space, access to and use of cyberspace and the Internet are emerging elements in global commerce, politics, and power. Any nation wishing to assert itself globally must take account of this new global commons. The Internet is also playing an increasingly important role in warfare and human political conflict. From the early use of the Internet by Zapatista insurgents in Mexico to the war in Kosovo, communication by computer has added a new dimension to warfare. Moreover, the use of the Internet to spread computer viruses reveals how easy it can be to disrupt the normal functioning of commercial and even military computer networks. Any nation which cannot assure the free and secure access of its citizens to these systems will sacrifice an element of its sovereignty and its power. It is clear that for the U.S. Armed Forces to remain preeminent and avoid an Achilles heel in the exercise of its power, they must be sure that these potential future forms of warfare favor America, just as today's air, land, and sea warfare reflect United States military dominance. You are listening to excerpts from Rebuilding America's Defenses, Strategy, Forces, and Resources for a New Century, produced by the Project for the New American Century, Transforming U.S. Conventional Forces. Much has been written in recent years about the need to transform the conventional armed forces of the United States to take advantage of the revolution in military affairs. The process of transformation within the Defense Department has yet to bear serious fruit. The two visions of transformation promulgated by the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Joint Vision 2010 and the Joint Vision 2020, have been broad statements of principles and of commitment to transformation, but very little change can be seen in the acquisition of new weapons systems. The process of transformation has yet to be linked to the strategic tasks necessary to maintain American military dominance. New classes of sensors, commercial and military, on land, on and under sea, in the air, and in space, will be linked together in dense networks that can be rapidly configured and reconfigured to provide future commanders with an unprecedented understanding of the battlefield. Ballistic and cruise missiles and long-range unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs, will make it much easier to project military power around the globe. Munitions themselves will become increasingly accurate, while new methods of attack, electronic, non-lethal, biological, will be more widely available. In time, the art of warfare on air, land, and sea will be vastly different than it is today, and combat likely will take place in new dimensions in space, cyberspace, and perhaps the world of microbes. Air warfare may no longer be fought by pilots manning tactical fighter aircraft sweeping the skies of opposing fighters, but a regime dominated by long-range, stealthy, unmanned craft. On land, the clash of massive combined arms, armored forces may be replaced by the dashes of much lighter, stealthier, and information-intensive forces augmented by fleets of robots, some small enough to fit in the soldiers' pockets. Control of the sea could be largely determined not by the fleets of surface combatants and aircraft carriers, but from land and space-based systems, forcing navies to maneuver and fight underwater. Space itself will become a theater of war as nations gain access to space capabilities and come to rely on them. Information systems will become an important focus of attack, particularly for U.S. enemies seeking to short-circuit sophisticated American forces. And advanced forms of biological warfare that can target specific genotypes may transform biological warfare from the realm of terror to a politically useful tool. While the exact scope and nature of such change is a matter for experimentation, Army studies already suggest that it will be dramatic. Consider the potential changes that might affect the infantrymen. Future soldiers may operate in encapsulated, climate-controlled fighting suits laced with sensors and boasting chameleon-like active camouflage. Skin patch pharmaceuticals help regulate fears, focus, concentration, and enhance endurance and strength. A display mounted on the soldier's helmet permits a comprehensive view of the battlefield, in effect, to look around corners and over hills, and allows the soldier to access the entire combat information and intelligence system while filtering incoming data to prevent overload. Individual weapons are more lethal, and the soldier's ability to call for highly precise and reliable indirect fires, not only from Army systems, but those of other services, allows each individual to have great influence over huge spaces. Under the Land Warrior Program, some Army experts envision a squad of seven soldiers able to dominate an area the size of the Gettysburg battlefield, where in 1863, some 165,000 men fought. Global strikes from air and space. The rapidly growing ability of the U.S. Air Force to conduct precision strikes over increasingly greater range marks a significant change in the nature of high-technology warfare. From the Gulf War through the air war for Kosovo, the sophistication of Air Force precision bombing continued to grow. As the relative value of electronic systems and precision munitions increases, the need for advanced manned aircraft appears to be lessening. Moreover, as the importance of East Asia grows in U.S. military strategy, the requirements for range and endurance may outweigh traditional measures of aircraft performance. In particular, the Air Force's emphasis on traditional tactical air operations is handicapping the nation's ability to maintain and extend its dominance in space. The Air Force should target significant new investments towards creating capabilities for operating in space, including inexpensive launch vehicles, new satellites, and transatmospheric vehicles, in preparation for a decision as to whether space warfare is sufficiently different from combat within Earth's atmosphere so as to require a separate space service. The price of American preeminence. As admitted above, calculating the exact price of armed forces capable of maintaining American military preeminence today and extending it into the future requires more detailed analysis than this broad study can provide. We believe it is necessary to increase slightly the personal strength of U.S. forces. Many of the missions associated with patrolling the expanding American security perimeter are manpower intensive, and planning for major theater wars must include the ability for politically decisive campaigns, including extended post-combat stability operations. Also, this expanding perimeter argues strongly for new overseas bases and forward operating locations to facilitate American political and military operations around the world. In Europe, the Persian Gulf, and East Asia, enduring U.S. security interests argue forcefully for an enduring American military presence. There should be a strong strategic synergy between U.S. forces overseas and in a reinforcing posture. Units operating abroad are an indication of American geopolitical interests and leadership, provide significant military power to shape events, and in wartime create the conditions for victory when reinforced. Conversely, maintaining the ability to deliver an unquestioned knockout punch through the rapid introduction of stateside units will increase the shaping power of forces operating overseas and the vitality of our alliances. In sum, we see an enduring need for large-scale American forces. But while arguing for improvements in today's armed services and force posture, we are unwilling to sacrifice the ability to maintain preeminence in the long term. If the United States is to maintain its preeminence, and the military revolution now underway is already an American-led revolution, the Pentagon must begin in earnest to transform U.S. military forces. The program we advocate, one that would provide America with forces to meet the strategic demands of the world's sole superpower, requires budget levels to be increased from 3.5 to 3.8% of the GDP. A sensible plan would add $15 billion to $20 billion to total defense spending annually. Through the Future Years Defense Program, this would result in a defense top-line increase of $75 billion to $100 billion over that period, a small percentage of the $700 billion on-budget surplus now projected for that same period. We believe that the new president should commit to a plan to achieve that level of spending within 4 years. Only such a force posture, service structure, and level of defense spending will provide America and its leaders with a variety of forces to meet the strategic demands of the world's sole superpower. Keeping the American peace requires the U.S. military to undertake a broad array of missions. There can be no retreat from these missions without compromising American leadership and the benevolent order it secures. This is the choice we face. It is not a choice between preeminence today and preeminence tomorrow. Global leadership is not something exercised at our leisure. When the mood strikes us, or when our core national security interests are directly threatened, then it is already too late. Rather, it is a choice whether or not to maintain American military preeminence, to secure American geopolitical leadership, and to preserve the American peace.
You heard excerpts from a document by the Project for the New American Century. The reader was Meme Troop founder R.G. Davis. Written in 2000, the document by the Project for the New American Century amounts to no less than a blueprint for U.S. military world rule. It was commissioned by Richard Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, and others. The 75-page document remained secret until it was discovered in September 2002. And here is a postscript from the viewpoint of August 2016. As media and public are trying to find an explanation of the aggressive militarism that pervades the presidential campaigns, judge for yourself how important the influence of neoconservatives and their programmatic text by the Project for the New American Century remains. In 2006, when it became increasingly clear that the Iraq War had become a foreign policy disaster, PNAC was replaced with a foreign policy initiative, also founded by William Crystal and Robert Kagan. However, the neoconservative policies did not change. 8 years later, writing in the May 26, 2014 issue of the liberal New Republic, PNAC co-founder Robert Kagan published what some observers saw as an update of PNAC, an essay entitled "Superpowers Don't Get to Reach Higher, What Our Tired Country Still Owes the World." The media saw it as a critique of President Obama, whose foreign policy was not aggressive enough for the self-proclaimed liberal interventionists, a term Kagan now prefers as opposed to neocon. One might ask, how much more intervention could Kagan be calling for, given that the overthrow of Gaddafi in Libya and regime change in Syria, that Obama had begun by supplying arms to anti-government militias in Syria, were clearly stated goals in PNAC's governing document. When Hillary Clinton became Secretary of State, she brought PNAC co-founder Robert Kagan on as an advisor after he had previously worked for presidential candidate John McCain. And as mentioned in part one, Clinton appointed Kagan's wife, Victoria Nuland, as her spokesperson, despite Nuland having served as a top aide to Iraq war hawk Vice President Richard Cheney. Nuland then proceeded with regime change in Ukraine, an anti-Russian move that also fits into the Cold War extension strategies of PNAC. Robert Kagan is now endorsing Hillary Clinton as president. One might say the biggest gift Obama provided to Kagan and the neoconservatives behind PNAC, as well, of course, to President Bush, Cheney, and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, was what many call his presidential pardon of war criminals. As will be remembered, Obama announced upon taking office that rather than examining those behind the false information that gave the Bush administration an excuse to invade Iraq, that the U.S. would look forward, not backward. Even the Nobel Committee that had awarded the president its prestigious Peace Prize on the basis of his opposition to the war in Iraq must have been stunned by that. Thanks to broadcaster Jeffrey Blankford for providing material for this postscript. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to the Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. This week, we'll be talking about the continuing danger of nuclear weapons with my friend, who is an anti-nuke activist, Leonard Iger. Leonard coordinates media and outreach for Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action up in Washington State. Since retiring from a career as an occupational and environmental health professional, Leonard has devoted much of his time to the abolition of nuclear weapons. He initiated the No to New Trident campaign to stop production of the Navy's new fleet of ballistic missile submarines, and Leonard maintains a blog, The Nuclear Abolitionist, to educate and engage people to work for a nuclear weapons-free world. If you go to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, you can get the links to all of those things that Leonard is involved in. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back with Leonard Iger. Leonard Iger, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you. This is wonderful, a real privilege to be aboard.
Well, tell my listeners a little bit about yourself, and then we'll talk about the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action.
Ooh, about myself. Well, yeah. In brief, I'm a retired public health professional. I worked in occupational environmental health in my professional career, and that, my graduate training, which included the study of radiological health, the effects of radiation on people, and I had vivid memories from that, these visual memories, even though it was all numbers and statistics, but it was about people and the effects of radiation on humans. And everything I was learning in graduate school was about the effects of Hiroshima and Nagasaki on the victims,
right.
Those who survived. And so that stayed with me. And so, you know, I was working in the 1980s, and here we are now, 2016, for the last decade. After working in social justice work for a long time, I decided to devote myself to one singular goal, and that is abolishing nuclear weapons from the face of the earth. I realized there weren't enough people doing that. You know, it's not pretty work. It's not the popular cause out there, but it is good work. And so I've been working with Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action, and really enjoying my work, meeting wonderful people, and doing what we have to do. So that's
Leonard,
kind of a brief sense.
Leonard, before we talk about the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Actions, a place that I've visited before, it's very lovely and peaceful and has a really great energy, I think, and that's in a big part to your presence there and your influence on it. But you said that working against nuclear weapons is not popular. There's not a lot of people doing it anymore. But my very first foray into activism was supporting the anti-nuke, whether it was nuclear power plants or nuclear weapons. I think it was back in like the early 80s. It seemed to be like a vibrant movement. Why do you think that it has diminished now? Was it the end of the Cold War? Do people mistakenly think that there's no danger of nuclear annihilation anymore?
Yes. Well, it is complex, but I think in large part it is what people thought was the peace dividend at the end of the Cold War. People just made an assumption, I think, by and large, that the Cold War is over. We have nothing to fear anymore. All the weapons have gone away, and we can go on business as usual. And yet the weapons did not go away. And although people will cite the statistics that at the height of the Cold War, and especially in the 80s when there were somewhere in the range of between 50 and 60,000, depending on the exact year, nuclear warheads out there. And now there are a fraction of that, probably 15,000 roughly, of all the nuclear-armed nations. The weapons that are left, the warheads left, are the most deadly of all. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. and Russia have most of those weapons. But to stay on your question, people, it's been out of people's minds. And there's also been a mindset historically, especially during the Cold War, nuclear weapons were the unspeakable. People did not even talk about them. It was not something that people wanted to think with and yet about, and yet we lived under that shadow. And so even today, it's one of those things for those that do know they're out there and that they are a danger. It's something they can't bring themselves to approach. It's so unthinkable, so horrific, and it instills such fear that people choose not to deal with it, I believe. It's a very large part. And the government likes that. I believe the U.S. government, the reason that the naval base gets that hangar where Ground Zero has property next door, the reason that's behind a very modest chain link and barbed wire fence and hidden away well deep behind conifers in the beautiful Pacific Northwest is that they want it out of sight and also out of mind so that they continue to deploy those weapons and to modernize them and just go on, again, business as usual, as if it were the Cold War.
Well, you point out what's that thing called, press release that you sent me,
yes,
that the U.S. is spending more on its nuclear arsenal today than it did during the Cold War. Is that in real dollars or is that in comparable dollars?
You know, in terms of real or comparable, forgive me, I'm not positive. Uh-huh. I do know that in total dollars that are to be spent over the next 30 years, in today's dollars, I understand that the U.S. government is going to spend $1 trillion on the modernization of U.S. nuclear weapons systems. That includes the submarines, the ballistic missile submarines, bombers, land-based missiles, warhead refurbishment, as they call it, or replacement, and possibly a new cruise missile, which is a missile that can be launched from under the wings of bombers. And, of course, the whole infrastructure that supports the weapons, not just the military bases, but also Los Alamos laboratories and all of the facilities that research, develop, and manufacture the weapons. So it's a huge, expansive nuclear weapons complex. And, you know, the irony is that the Cold War ended, and that was the time that we should have ramped back, and we did not. And I can speak in terms of Trident, the Trident nuclear weapon system, that we kept our submarines out on patrol, on alert status, this entire time, not at Cold War levels, but still significant patrols. And we've also moved, since the end of the Cold War, more of the submarines from the Atlantic side to the Pacific side. So now, as it said in the news release, there are 8 Trident subs based Bangor on the Pacific coast during Washington, and the other 6 are at Kings Bay, Georgia, on the Atlantic coast. And that's part of the pivot to Asia, the Asia-Pacific pivot. And ironically, even though that's because of China principally, it still threatens Russia. We're doing it from both coasts. And so we're developing a new arms race, a new Cold War is brewing. And it just can spiral out of control if we continue leading the way, which it seems that we are. Russia and China are both responding. China has been developing its own ballistic missile submarine force and deploying those submarines. And of course, Russia has also been building new ballistic missile submarines and developing a new missile. And it just goes on and on. And no one is sitting down and saying, why are we doing this? Why don't we negotiate an end to this? for instance, President Obama and President Putin, the two powers that need to lead the way to disarmament since they have the lion's share of nuclear weapons.
Yeah, it's still so scary. And, you know, nobody's sitting down and saying that because it seems to be super profitable.
Yes, it is very profitable. Interestingly enough, from my area of expertise with Trident, the Trident weapon system is one of the triad, as the government calls it. There are three legs of the nuclear triad, the submarines, ballistic missile submarines, the land-based missiles, or ICBMs, spread around the United States, and then, of course, the bombers that drop gravity bombs or could also fire the cruise missiles. So there are those three legs. And by far, and this has been stated in official government documents, that the Trident submarines represent the most survivable leg of that nuclear triad. And so I like to call it, it's the crown jewel of the government's nuclear weapons programs. If they had to give up two out of three programs, it would not be the Trident submarines. And they're currently planning, the government is planning, and in research and development, to build a new generation of submarines, because the older submarines are aging and will have to be retired over the next few decades. And so they're going to build 12 new ballistic missile submarines at a cost of approximately $100 billion. It's a huge cost, and it's also a question of, do we want to keep up this arms race, this nuclear submarine arms race? But it is profitable. And the company that will be the principal contractor for the new boat, speaking of profits, is General Dynamics Electric Boat. And out there on the East Coast, you know, boat building is big, and Electric Boat is a huge contractor with the government, building not just the ballistic missile submarines, but also attack submarines, along with another major shipyard. But it's huge profits, and the members of Congress in those districts are speaking out for this and supporting it because it's bringing quote-unquote jobs and revenue to their districts. And so it is, it is about money. It's a whole political process, and there's a huge defense lobby, which you're very well familiar with, and General Dynamics and all of these associated contractors that build the systems for this new submarine are deeply, deeply invested in their lobbying efforts, and they're reaping huge rewards, no matter what the consequences, no matter how these submarines might one day be used, God forbid. They are looking at immediate profits, and they're going to keep that revenue stream going.
There's not one congressional district in this country that doesn't have a military profiteer in it. It's very insidious.
That is correct.
A military base, or a you know, any kind of military researching. Every university gets a lot of money from the Pentagon to do research. It's just so insidious. It's just completely disgusting.
It is really a difficult one. Sometime back in researching the Defense Department contracts, it went right down to Krispy Kreme donuts, ironically. Everyone, there's practically not any decent-sized company, from Coca-Cola and Federal Express and Microsoft, that you can almost name any company that has some DoD contract. Of course, there you have it. It is like these chemicals, this cancer, if you will, that is spread, it's metastasized throughout our whole economy. And so to ramp back, to change that, is very difficult. Right in Kitsap County, there the naval base Bangor is part of a larger naval operations there with Bremerton, the large shipyard in Bremerton, which actually is where they decommissioned the nuclear reactors from the submarines and other ships. It's huge, and the employment there is in the tens of thousands. So there has to be a real paradigm shift to be able to say, you know, we need to make this shift from spending on war, especially something like nuclear weapons, which are not about fighting a war, but they're about the end.
Right.
You don't fight a war, you annihilate each other and everyone else that's involved. That's a whole other conversation. And so how do we make that shift? And ironically, there are parts of the country where, going back some years, they decommissioned military bases and local communities came together and they created alternative forms of employment, and they re-stimulated their local economies, and it worked from the West Coast to the East Coast. And, you know, my dream is that one day we'll be able to have a binding nuclear arms convention, and the U.S. and Russia will lead the way on that, and, you know, someday we'll see Naval Base Kitsap Banger being converted into a research and development park for alternative energy parts of a new and sustainable life-giving economy. And, you know, it's not a pipe dream, and I don't think it's as naive as it sounds up front to many people. I think it's very practical when we look at the challenges of climate change and so many other challenges that we face.
I live literally next door to one of the biggest Air Force bases in the world, Travis Air Force Base, and I just really, there's so much we could do, you know, as communities that surround Travis. You know, there's so much we could do that could, you know, benefit society with that thing out there.
Yes, yes. Well, it's interesting because next week, I believe it is, some of the folks from Ground Zero Center will be leafleting at the Banger base, at the gate, the entrance gate, where employees will be coming and going, mostly entering early in the morning. And the leaflet they're using for this month is titled, "What Does National Security Mean to You?" And what you just said really brings to mind, you know, that whole question. There are two concepts that kind of keep leading us into more and more nuclear modernization. One is strategic nuclear deterrence, that we have to have this deterrent to defend ourselves, protect ourselves and our allies. And then the phrase of national security, always citing national security. And I keep thinking, well, wait a minute, what is national security and as opposed to insecurity, when there are an increasing number of American families struggling with bills, with rent and medicine and education, and, you know, just so many needs that we have, with homelessness and hunger and infrastructure that's falling apart, and our healthcare system as well as our education system, students incurring huge debt. There's so many levels of this that are making our nation more insecure, I believe, and so do many others, I think. And here we are spending so much, not just on the military in general, but on nuclear weapons, which are absolutely antithetical to life. You know, they can only be used for one thing,
mm-hmm.
and you know, the countless billions of people that would die directly and indirectly, you know, from nuclear war. It's just madness to even keep going down this road. And yet, even with President Obama's rhetoric, we keep spending money on that instead of really thinking about what is true national security. You know, where is diplomacy and that? But as you said, you know, there's Travis Air Force Base and dozens and dozens of other military installations in this country and what they represent. And
hundreds.
You know,
hundreds and hundreds. Yeah, and not only do we have an Air Force Base, we have two prisons in Vacaville, too. So our economy is based on just oppression. And it's just so And so it's that, it's not just a mindset of the people in power, it's a mindset of our neighbors, really, that we have to deal with. Well, Leonard, let's talk, tell us about the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action, and then let's talk about the controversial ad that's being placed on Seattle buses.
Of course, of course. Ground Zero, in brief, was founded in 1977, and a very short story that really underpins that. There was an engineer working on the new reentry vehicle, which is the device that sits atop a missile and contains the warhead and guides that warhead down to its target. And his name is Bob Aldrich. And Bob was working at that time for Lockheed Martin, and he realized, he had an epiphany, and he realized that he was not developing just a second strike weapon, which is what the government refers to the Trident missile on the submarines as a weapon that would be used if another country, the Soviet Union in those days, were to fire nuclear missiles at us, we would fire a counterattack, a second strike. Well, he realized that the very nature of this weapon, because of its accuracy and a number of other factors, made it potentially a first strike weapon. Or we, if we were even threatened, thinking that the Soviets might attack us, we could fire a first strike and wipe out their silos before they could strike at us. So he went to Jim Douglas. And from there, Jim Douglas was an educator and peace activist. And Jim and Shelley, Shelley, his wife, they were up in Canada, came down to the area surrounding Naval Base Kitsap-Banger, found a piece of property and began a presence there of leafleting and trying to become part of the community. And ultimately, that led to protests where people actually sat down and blocked the trains, what were called the white trains that brought in the nuclear warheads and the rocket motors. And you mentioned about the 80s, a time where there were millions of people at one time in the 80s demonstrating against nuclear weapons. And so in the 70s and 80s, there were thousands of people that demonstrated against nuclear weapons at the Banger Trident base. And many of them, hundreds at that time, were arrested. Interestingly enough, even the Seattle, the Catholic Archbishop Hunthausen, stood with the protesters there and actually withheld part of his federal taxes in protest of our nation's continuing involvement in an arms race. And he's known for his comment calling the naval base Kitsap-Banger the Auschwitz of Puget Sound, which sounds extreme, but in a very real sense, he called them flying ovens. They were only for one thing, just mass annihilation. So right. Ground Zero is,
Go ahead.
Yes. So Ground Zero has been around since that time. And essentially, it offers people the opportunity to explore the roots of violence and injustice in our world and to experience the power of love through nonviolent direct action. So basically focusing on Trident, but of course working to abolish all nuclear weapons. We come together regularly, at a minimum of three times a year, for nonviolent direct actions at the Banger base, nonviolence training, and a host of things that we try to do together. We invite people to come join us, and we engage in nonviolent resistance to Trident. And it's been going on all these years, and we continue that work. And then, of course, every now and then we try something new and creative, and you mentioned the bus ad. And one of our members at one point, Rodney Brunel, came up with the idea of doing an ad on the side of the Seattle City buses, the Seattle Metro Transit buses, that would bring attention to the issue of nuclear weapons right here in our front yard, Puget Sound, just 20 miles west of Seattle. And so working with Seattle Metro Transit and their advertising agency, Rodney and others from Ground Zero, came up with this wonderful ad that has been on Metro Transit buses since almost the end of June and will run well into the month of August. And this ad is a bright yellow banner that says, 20 miles west of Seattle is the largest concentration of deployed nuclear weapons in the U.S. And just to the left of the yellow banner is a map showing a red dot at Naval Base Kitsap-Banger, the home of the Trident submarines, and also the Strategic Weapons Facility Pacific, where the nuclear weapons are stored. And a nice dotted line almost due west of Seattle, 20 miles away. And the idea of this ad is to generate an awareness among people, because ironically, people, for the most part, in our area are not aware that there are nuclear weapons here, that there is a nuclear submarine base, and they have no knowledge whatsoever. They're shocked when they hear about this. Very small percentage of people that even know about it. So we're trying to create an awareness, and hopefully that will lead to people wanting to know more, to learn more, and to generate a dialogue, a conversation, which we don't have in this country. If you followed what's going on in the United Kingdom, they're having a huge debate about the Trident nuclear weapon system there. They have four Trident submarines, essentially almost the same submarine as ours. It does carry actually the same Trident missile as the U.S. submarines and share some of the same command and control systems. And in the U.K., they're having a massive dialogue and debate in their parliament, for instance. And we have none of that in this country. There is not even a peep. Yes, we're seeing an occasional article here and there about nuclear weapons, but there's no debate about should we build 12 new ballistic missile submarines. The only debate has been in Congress about where are we going to get the money to build them. And that's another issue about Navy shipbuilding and the impact of Trident on that. But the bus ad, we hope, will generate a conversation, just like today. I thank you for your interest in this, because it's so important if we are to make any headway in the work of disarmament and abolishing nuclear weapons. There has to be a conversation. People have to, citizens, have to engage in this conversation, because, as you indicated, there is so much money involved in this, and there are so many powerful interests, and there's momentum. It's like kinetic energy. Once that ball is rolling downhill, it's a big, heavy one, and it is so hard to stop it. And it takes engagement of the citizenry, an informed citizenry, as we've seen with every issue, to make any headway on nuclear weapons and bringing pressure there on our elected officials and educating our elected officials, many of whom really don't understand the real impact of nuclear weapons. They just go by the rhetoric of we need to maintain our strategic nuclear deterrent and it's all about national security, but they don't go any deeper than that. They go on what they're told by the lobbyists and the people in the military whose jobs rely on these weapon systems like Trident.
Right. Well, I'm not so sure our elected officials don't know. I mean, they're mostly all older than we are, and they've gone through the Cold War and the nightmare scenario. And, you know, they have that, the Congress has that bunker that they're going to go on in if there's any... if there's any danger. But still, it's just amazing to me. As we're speaking, I have three of my grandchildren here, and it's just so personal. It's like, I'm sure the Congress people have family all over the country that aren't going to be available, you know, their bunkers aren't going to be available for them. And it's just, to me, it's just so monstrous that they even support these weapons of total annihilation.
Yes, you know, I do agree with you that there, in a very real sense, there is no excuse for our elected officials, politicians, members of Congress, not to understand the real risks and understand what nuclear weapons should represent and actually take a different tack. Because, as you said, it's really about future generations. And ironically, yes, that's, I didn't talk about that initially, but one of the principal reasons that I do this work is not just because I have two children and want to see a better future for them in every way, but the future generations, the seven generations, if you will. We owe a debt to future generations to give them a chance. And they have so many challenges, you know, even without nuclear weapons, climate change and so many other things that they will have to deal with. And if we at least give them a fighting chance, so to speak. And nuclear weapons are something that, in a certain sense, would be, it would be so simple. If we could get them off the table, if we could eradicate these absurd and insane weapons, then it would change everything, because we owe it to our children and our grandchildren. I see it as a moral and ethical responsibility, because for me, they are, it's totally immoral. And any involvement in producing, developing, and deploying nuclear weapons to me is immoral. And I don't mean to judge the enlisted personnel on those submarines. They make their own choices, but these weapons are an affront to our humanity, and they threaten all of humanity. So we need to bring that to the table. And personally, I hope that with this bus ad that it can lead to, as I said, an increasing conversation, but also to try to be more and more creative in our dialogue and our advertising, the way we present this issue. And I think it's on right now, there's a play called Daisy, and it's about the famous Daisy ad that Lyndon Johnson used. You know, as I understand it, back in that day, using it to defeat Barry Goldwater, it was the ad where there was a young girl
Daisy.
Picking the daisy. And in the background, she was singing a little song, lovely song, and in the background was a countdown. And at the very end, the image of a nuclear mushroom cloud as a bomb detonated. And it was extraordinarily graphic. And it had such an impact. And it was the beginning of evidently that negative type of advertising used in political campaigns. But for me, the message there was it was so impactful. Mm-hmm. It was such a bold and impactful way of reaching people viscerally. And we need to do that. And I don't want to make people fearful. I don't want to use the fear tactics. I don't, like we heard in last night's speech at the Republican convention, I don't believe in that. But I do want people to listen.